iHeartRadio.com. Also, listen to us anywhere with the iHeartRadio app.
I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Casey.
And we'll see you next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Peter and Jalene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jalene.
Thank you very much. Hey, Occupy Everywhere.
Occupy WRIF in the Motor City.
Where did you go? Why are you sliding around on that chair?
I was adjusting my levels, Peter.
Okay. That's good. Welcome. We are doing a talk show. Please join us at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. Whoa, man.
We're ready. Our email, calltalkyes, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And more and more Facebook friends are joining us at facebook.com/nightcall. And it's not really friends, we've learned. You have to click like.
Yeah.
Because it's
a group.
It's a group, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so you can join like that.
And what a group we are.
Yeah, and you know what's choking me up? Water. Why do they have water do this?
Oh, Peter.
There you go.
You psyched yourself out.
I did.
Talking about choking on the air.
Yeah. You know, I'm always telling guests, never pound on the desk.
Yeah.
You know,
or right. Do this. You know, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of rules.
A lot of rules here on radio.
And
are we on yet?
We don't really like rules, but there are some that we follow.
There's some that are good.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we will have a podcast of this show ready by noon tomorrow. Thank you to Athena and Sarah, who will take your calls at 313-298.
Yes, be nice.
WRIF.
If you're angry, save it for us.
Yeah.
We can take it.
But there's no reason to be angry. Things are looking better because money power is being challenged.
Yes.
Probably the first time.
Whether they like it or not.
The first time in 100 years someone has said, and someone, this is the mega plural, mm-hmm. all over the world are saying, we don't like it that the 1% control everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And more of these Occupy groups are popping up all over the world and the country. Sadly, they've been met with a lot of police violence, I would say.
There was a photograph that showed the NYPD. I hope everybody's getting rid of their NYPD hats and shirts and all that.
You know, I mean, it's been pretty ugly if you've really paid attention.
This is a horrible police force. It really should be in receivership. The way that the federal courts move in and say that this has to be monitored.
It was like LAPD, remember? Yeah. They were just the worst. Forever.
Major corruption.
And was it Philly?
In New Orleans.
Yeah.
And Detroit. Yeah. But the 400 richest people in the world have $1.5 trillion in wealth. And I was taking a look at this list. The 400 richest Americans are worth $270 billion.
Billions. Okay.
Yeah, billions. And that's gone up. I think this is last year's. And what was I thinking? Yeah. Here, 400 richest people in the world are worth $1.5 trillion. Take all of this money and leave them with a paltry $1 billion apiece.
Okay. You go, taking people's money again,
so
Peter.
All they have is 400, this $400 billion, and it leaves $1 trillion throughout the world to deal with the kind of debt crises that they and the other 1% have gotten the world into. Pardon me.
Completely unaffected by what's going on in the economy. I mean, it's as if they're in a little happy diamond bubble.
They're a little concerned, though, what's going on. I mean, they are kind of worried that the whole world economy is going to crash.
Well, of course, because that's the only thing they care about.
You know, pardon me, whose fault it is? Those Greeks who won't agree to having their salaries cut and their pensions ended. It's not their fault.
I mean, how dare they?
So do you get that, folks? If just pry $1 trillion out of these banksters and financiers and CEOs and all that, they still got $1 billion so they can do anything they want and buy almost anything they want. Some of them can't because they're so insanely acquisitive that they would say, no, you can't. Yeah, I have...
Is that how they talk?
Yeah. Well, they when you have them by the cojones.
Oh, yeah. The voice goes a little higher.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But that's not even... I just started talking about that right off the bat.
Yeah.
Here in Detroit, there was an Occupy Detroit March. Hundreds of supporters. Today.
And that was a pretty big one.
500 people. And this is according to a newspaper that historically is always underestimated.
I know. And always lean to the right.
Yeah, but you know, they've been really good about this. So I'm sorry, Christine Ferretti, excuse me if I'm challenging your capacity to count. I never know how they count.
Well, I think it's just kind of like,
remember, a couple Fridays ago, we went to the first Occupy Detroit March, right?
Yeah.
How many people were there? I don't know.
I'm horrible at crowd calculation.
Well, why is...
I always have been.
Well, I wonder...
Even at rock concerts.
I wonder whether Christine Ferretti... Hey, Christine, if you're listening, call us up at 313-298-WRIF. They were doing things where, for these huge marches in Washington and all, and New York City, where there'd be like a million people protesting a particular war or something like that, they would do aerial shots and then count. But here
Which seems weird.
Yeah, it's just a guesstimate. And so when we went on that march for Occupy Detroit, when it was established a couple of weeks ago, was there 1,000 people or was there 500? I don't know.
No idea.
In Oakland, when there was a general strike on Wednesday for Occupy Oakland, and it was motivated by another horrid police force, the Oakland cops.
It's really bad.
Totally militarized, using all sorts of projectiles firing into a crowd of unarmed people. Yeah. And, I saw this online. It showed the NYPD all, robocopped out, armor all over them, shin guards, huge sticks, batons.
We've been right next to that in Washington, D.C. a few times.
Face guards, you're right, in Miami as well.
Oh, that was probably, well, I don't know. They were both equally bad.
But the caption under this shot of the riot police walking up the street was, you can always tell who's coming to riot by how they're dressed.
Right, because everyone else is in T-shirts and jeans.
No, I always say shorts and flip-flops.
Right.
Yeah, 20-year-olds in shorts and flip-flops, and these 37-year-old guys in RoboCop outfits. Again, this is not their decision. There are some men that make individually I would even say felonious assaults on demonstrators because they can't control themselves. And there's a certain element on every police force, and every cop in the world knows that there's guys.
Percentage of angry cops.
Yeah, very angry, and just anybody who crosses their path is going to get smacked around, and brutal cops are corrupt cops. Corrupt cops are brutal cops. There's a real connection there, and since the New York Police Department is extraordinarily corrupt, and again, it's not like they're 90% corrupt. Maybe they're 6% corrupt.
Yeah.
I have no idea what the figures are.
Right.
But when you have that kind of mentality and also the mentality of permissiveness, you get into these kind of situations. And I was saying last week, two things I was saying. One, they are ordered there.
Absolutely.
They're also ordered what to wear.
Yes.
Because here in Detroit, the police just have regular uniforms
on.
They're extraordinarily cooperative.
They've been great. We are really lucky here.
Yeah, they have very, very few, if any, overtime costs. See if I can...
And I want to say, by speaking of police, our friends from the Oakland County Sheriff's just drove by again. So, and they protect this building, and they protect us, and we appreciate them.
Yeah.
Hey, guys and gals.
And they're thinking, how come you're talking bad about the cops? Well, I think any professional police officer knows that it's the whole thing about rotten apples. They have the capacity to spoil the whole barrel. I mean, the police officers in the main, or overwhelmingly, or 99%, don't join police forces so they can kick the crap out of demonstrators.
Right.
They have this sense they want to protect the community.
Protect and serve. And do all of that. And they do that. I mean, they've been helpful to me on a few occasions, and I'll never forget that. That's for sure.
Yeah, particularly the guys that are driving around here.
Yeah. And Michigan State Police, because now they're on duty.
Yeah.
Peter, I don't know what you're looking for.
I forgot.
Okay. Oh, no. Why don't you just move on?
Well, I got this whole pile of police attacks on...
Atlanta was one that happened.
Atlanta, that was it. Yeah, okay. Here. Police arrested 20 people after an Occupy Atlanta protest rally in a city park spilled onto the streets, and officers converged on them on motorcycles, on horseback, and in riot gear.
Yeah. They said get out of there by 11 o'clock, and there was a certain group, as there is at almost every protest, that says, no, we're not leaving.
Because they have the idea that public space is defined by the first word, public.
Yeah, they have that idea, but there are... I hate to say it, but there are rules that a lot of parks close at 11 o'clock. And, I'm not saying I wouldn't not stay behind.
I think probably some of those rules are good. But, there's circumstances in which the definition of what's going on is more important than this absolute rule.
For example, Grand Circus Park in downtown Detroit.
Yeah, exactly. Because the city of Detroit is letting people stay there 24 hours a day, even though it violates the city ordinances because... The city administration realizes that the constitutional right of peacefully assembling for redress of grievances is more important than absolutely, adhering to this ordinance. And what are they going to do in Detroit? I mean, here's what they did in Atlanta. A crowd of several hundred protesters, and I don't even like the word. I mean, that's what they are. So it should be several hundred citizens had gathered in Woodruff Park, the scene of about 50 arrests of demonstrators last month, and set up tents. Organizers said they planned to stay overnight despite warnings from the mayor and the police that anyone there past 11 p.m. closing would be arrested. But as 11 p.m. approached, protesters began decamping policefully.
Peacefully.
Dozens of officers were on hand herding protesters away from the park's entrances and installing barricades around. A police helicopter flew overhead. Here's another city.
A helicopter? I thought, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's broke, like all big urban cities, and they're spending money on this. While most of the protesters left the park, a few people stayed behind, and as demonstrators poured onto Peachtree Street in downtown, a police officer on a motorcycle drove into the crowd.
Yeah. I know. Yeah,
good going, guy. Sparking a confrontation between officers and protests that turned tense at time, which meant the cops started kicking the crap out of people. Police officers in riot gear and on horseback filled the street, warning protesters to stay on the sidewalk. I mean, is this necessary? And you know what I said last week, and this is what I would ask police. You know, again, the average man or woman in the police force probably doesn't even have a lot to do. They say, okay, you're the mounted police, you go there. You're in a motorcycle or helicopter,
well, and think
you go
about
there.
It. I mean, how regimented it, the whole police officer
well, yeah.
thing is. Like, they're going to say no, Peter. You
right.
know, right?
Well, no. I don't expect they're going to say no.
Yeah.
But who? You know what? The city administration should say, these people that are encamped there are respected members of our city. They deserve.
Don't look at them.
They deserve. They don't, and that's what's wrong. They deserve every courtesy and treat them like they're your own family.
Yeah.
Because they might be, and if they're not, they're someone just like your family. And then they wouldn't. Would they have then? The start firing flash grenades and tear gas grenades and that into what happened here. Same thing in Seattle. Street clashes, arrests as bank leader speaks. This guy named Jamie Dimon, a CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. J.P. Morgan Chase received $25 billion in government bailout loans in 2008. That's what Bush got him with that. While thousands of homeowners were foreclosed on. They also pointed out, these are the people protesting, Diamond's salary and compensation last year, almost $21 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
While wages stagnated for most of the nation's workers.
Stagnated or stopped.
Yeah.
Or, you know, went backwards.
In Detroit, this Occupy Detroit march drew hundreds today, Sunday. On Wednesday, a number of people from Occupy Detroit went up to the Maccabees building near Wayne State University, and I don't have this in front of me, but there was another CEO there. I mean, some guy who's...
it was a Chase CEO.
Yeah, a bankster.
Mm-hmm.
And so a number of people stood up and said, hey, how do you justify... I can't remember the questions. And they arrested the people that were standing up and yelling questions at the guy.
Yeah, I know.
Right.
I mean,
and you can say maybe
freedom
it's,
of speech. What?
Yeah, maybe it's well. You can say, you know, it's not rude, or it is rude. You know, maybe they shouldn't have done that. But you know what? In times like these, when we have, I mean, aren't certain things more allowable as long as people aren't getting hurt? As long as and people are getting hurt only by the police.
Yes, absolutely. Not by each other.
Yeah, yeah. Here, a coalition of more than 500 union members, this is in Detroit, community organizations, students, seniors, and jobless workers gathered Sunday in Hart Plaza to march in solidarity with Occupy Wall Street. The group assembled Sunday afternoon at the Labor Legacy Monument. If you've never seen that, go check that out.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever seen that.
It's that big circle.
Oh!
That big metal almost circle.
Sure,
yeah. To pass through Detroit's financial district.
We have a financial district.
Yeah.
I know we don't have a diamond district.
No. The path through Detroit's financial district calling for Wall Street and big banks to be held accountable for their role in the ongoing jobs crisis. The group joins the growing movement in Detroit, one of encampments in cities nationwide in solidarity with Occupy Wall Street. Well, thank you, Christine Ferretti. And I never thought these words would ever pass my lips.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Detroit News.
I know. Miracles do happen. It's proof.
Yeah. Your thoughts on any of this? Are you participating in any of it? Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you at 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743, and we have open lines, so feel free to get us.
And we often get email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Oh, yes.
We never get snail mail.
No, that's not true.
We got one.
We do get snail mail, but it is very rare. I mean, snail mail is a dying art. Let's start with that. But we got an email.
Wait a minute. People can send it to me and Jalene.
Yeah.
Peter Werby, Jalene
and
Jordan.
Or.
At care of WRIF, 1 Radio Plaza, Ferndale, 48220.
Right away. We love letters.
So this is Todd from Livonia.
This is Todd. What's with the guy's name Todd?
Oh, I should have. Go ahead. I'll
okay.
See if I can...
But the thing is now, he likes the show. He enjoys listening to you and me. But he took me to task, Peter. I know. He said, "Dear Jalene, if I'm being overly familiar, forgive me, but I'm in that kind of mood. You'll see why later. That's where it started."
And I'm getting really sick of guys named Todd.
George Carlin. Yeah. Love his soul. This is what he's mad about. A seemingly innocuous comment you made last Sunday while discussing abortion, birth control, etc., which we discussed quite a lot on the show. Yeah. It's been gnawing at him ever since, and here was what I said that gnawed at him. And I'm still so confused. He said, I said, people are going to have sex. No! I mean, you know, I have said so many more inflammatory things on this show. So anyway, Todd goes on to say, well, yes, I hope so. So he kind of redeemed himself. Yeah. If we want to perpetuate the species, but that perpetuation by individuals not in the best financial or temperamental position to be bringing babies into the world is not a good thing.
Those darn poor people.
Oh, boy, that just broke my heart. I'm not saying I want a world in which only rich people have kids. Well, good. But the same terror I have of fathering a child I know I can't support should exist, at least to a certain degree. And all the jackrabbit screwers out there.
I thought that was supposed to be good.
That sounds like a good thing. With little or no regard for the public consequences their private acts may entail. In this one aspect, conservatives are justified in partially prying their noses into the bedrooms of America. No! No, they don't! Unintended pregnancies can affect everybody. This is what he's saying. Todd, from Livonia. Even when they're rectified by an abortion. Rectified! Yeah. Okay, let me repeat that. I'm steadfastly pro-choice, he says, but that doesn't mean I ever want to see society view abortion as just another birth control option either. Well, wait. I think you're really misreading things because we don't either.
Right? I don't even know what that means.
Please explain. Someone explain that to us. But let me finish this really quick.
Okay.
Also, in a world where violence against women is hardly a thing of the past, hearing a female, me, imply that we're all basically the sum product of uncontrollable urges was particularly troublesome for me. And I, you know, people hear what they want to hear. But, you know, hey, uncontrollable urges rock. Okay. imagine all the rapists out there who'd love to be able to blame it all on biology. Well, that's a little gross.
Yeah.
And come on, you know. I you took it a little far, Todd.
Well, here is the deal. I mean, in Eastern Europe, they're actually sometimes when people don't have birth control availability, or in some countries where there's such heavy domination by the Catholic Church that opposes availability
Ireland,
of birth control, that actually women, in a sense, use abortion as birth control because
they're forced to.
Well, when they get pregnant, you know, that's what they do. So, but, you know, I thought, I wonder how many abortions there's been since Roe v. Wade in 1973.
Yeah, what'd you find out?
And so I didn't realize it till after, but I got all these stats from
anti-abortion site, right?
A compulsory pregnancy site.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. I don't want to give them any publicity, but it says help this group and win a pro-life book. Click here.
Oh, how exciting. Yeah. I want one, Peter.
But here, number of abortions per year, this is staggering, approximately 42 million.
Worldwide,
okay. 115,000 a day.
And what's the population and how many of those are women? You know,
7 billion people on the
air. Okay.
Where abortions occur, 17% occur in what we call the developed countries, and 83% of them occur in what they called... what does this say?
Third world countries, underdeveloped.
No, they're repeating themselves here.
Oh, well, that's because that's them.
Damn, you know, this totally threw.
They need to learn how to proofread.
Yeah, it says 83% of all abortions are obtained in developing countries, and 17% occur in developed countries.
Okay.
I'm sorry, my fault.
Okay, okay.
So in other words, 17% in the West. Yeah, and the other 83% are in poor nations.
Yeah,
where
women aren't given health care, and where Bush took away all of that funding to help women with health care and issues
birth control.
Like this. Yeah.
All right, it
you
says
made it worse for these people.
Number of abortions per year in the United States: 1.37 million. And there's been 50 million abortions, they estimate, since 1973 in about 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I'm giving it away. I mean, the poor tend to have more abortions than people higher, you know, on the up in the pyramid.
Yeah, and there are so many factors, including, you know, education, availability of birth control, health care issues. You know, the list is long.
Here, 52% of women obtaining abortions in the U.S. are younger than 25.
Mm.
So the compulsory pregnancy people want these very young women who are unprepared for motherhood. Yeah, they're prepared to spread their legs. Yeah, well, hello, they are. You're right. And you want you wanted another 50 million. You know, if there would have been, if there wouldn't have been abortions in the United States, it's not that just that we lost 50 million people because there's this geometric spread of population, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if these so if there wouldn't have been, say that, because there always was abortions in the United States, even when it was illegal.
Yep.
Say that there would have been, oh, I don't know, 30 million. So 20 million would have been more live births, and that would have, so instead of having 300 million people here, maybe we'd have 400 million. That'd work, right? But let's see here. Where else?
Yeah, the situation with homelessness and poverty isn't already bad enough.
No, it's even
States.
It goes younger. Women aged 20 to 24 obtained a third of all abortions. Teenagers obtained 20%. Who's having abortions by marital status? 64. This surprised me. 64.4% of all abortions are performed on never married women.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Married women account for 18.4. And divorced women, 10%. Women identifying themselves as Protestant obtain 37.5% of all abortions in the U.S. Catholic women account for 31. So they, Catholic women do like a third of it. Jewish women, 1.3%. And women with no religious affiliation obtain 23.7%.
Oh, dirty women.
Yeah. And 18% of all abortions are performed on women who identify themselves as born-again evangelical.
Oh.
So, yeah, we're being cynical and laughing, but that abortion is part of the female reproductive galaxy.
Yeah, that's a good way to put
it. I'm trying to think
it's
how
it is. Galaxy. I like that.
Women have.
I have my own little galaxy going on down there.
Women have abortions all over the world, and when you. I don't know what the status, for instance, of legal abortions are in Asia and Africa.
Right.
But as we've talked about, in South America, in Latin America, rather, the only country in all of Latin America, or did they just, I think maybe they legalized it like in Mexico City.
Oh.
Or was that gay marriage? Something like that. Anyway. That
one controversial issue after another.
Right, is that all through Latin America, it's illegal. So women are still having abortions there, except they're having ones that are unsafe.
And probably dying.
Yeah.
Higher percentage than here for sure.
Women with family incomes less than 15,000, they account for almost 30% of all abortions. Women with family incomes between 15,000 and 30,000 obtain 20%. So what is it? 50% of women. So again, we're it's, you know, it has to do with poverty. And guess what? Women with family incomes over 60,000, only 13%. 1% of abortions occur because of rape or incest.
Incest.
Yeah. Well, sometimes, you know, man.
Yeah.
Let's light the incense. Light the incense.
Stop
all your head. Burn one. Yeah, wow, man. What would I do if you weren't here?
I don't know, Peter.
Yeah. 6% of abortions occur because of potential health problems, and 93% of all abortions occur for social reasons. The child is unwanted or inconvenient. And the language there is interesting.
Yeah, because this is on this pro, as they say, pro-life.
Yeah.
As if we're anti-life. Really, we're pro-death here. I mean, let's just, you know, go with what they say.
And how about
Jeez,
this? An estimated 43% of all women will have at least one abortion by the time they're 45 years old.
Wow.
So almost, and 47% of all abortions are performed on women who have had at least one previous abortion. So you have essentially these, although, you know, women are certainly involved in the compulsory pregnancy movement, it's overwhelmingly men.
Yeah.
And it all is about sexual repression.
Yeah.
It's all
controlling women.
Yeah. And as we said there, last week when we first began talking about that, there's two ways to substantially reduce abortion. first reduce poverty worldwide. And that gets back to the 400 richest men, a couple of few women in there, that have $1.5 trillion combined to these small infinitesimal slice. I can't, it's probably like 0.00001% of the world's population command
yep.
that much wealth. And so if you had a situation where, first off, that that people had the economic capacity to support children coming into their lives, you'd have much less abortion. And the other thing is people don't want a kid every time they have sex, because people sometimes do it, as you were saying earlier, for uncontrollable urges.
Dirty little jackrabbits.
Yeah, what did he say?
At least to a certain degree, in all the jackrabbit screwers out there.
Yeah. So if you had,
You know who you are.
How about this, all you compulsory pregnancy people? Why don't you advocate for free birth control
yeah.
available to women and men?
As my mama says, there should be a Planned Parenthood on every corner.
There you go.
I know.
And your mom's a Republican.
Marge, I know. She's... let's not even go into Marge's politics.
So what do you think about that, folks? Wouldn't that really make a lot of sense if you thought abortion was this horrible thing, that to, first off, raise the economic status? And that ties into the Occupy movement. That's what's going on here.
Raise the level of education.
And also free birth control available to everybody.
Perfect.
Yeah. Any objections to that?
You know, some people would object and probably say, well, that's going to encourage people to have sex.
Jackrabbit.
Like those jackrabbit screwers.
I love it. But we mentioned last week as well that Tuesday there's going to be an election in Mississippi where there's going to be the voters are going to face this constitutional amendment that would make it it would declare a fertilized human egg to be a legal person.
This is really scary stuff.
And it would effectively brand abortion and some forms of birth control as murder.
Murder. That and you just kind of danced around that part, Peter. To me, that's the biggest part.
Yeah. But more than one in five Mississippians is on food stamps. 15% of Americans, or 45.8 million people, are. And in Mississippi, it's 21.5% of residents in Mississippi are on food stamps.
I blame Bush still. Sorry, people.
So this is a very poor state, and they want to make sure that more and more people are born into Mississippi. All right. Occupy Everywhere, your comments. What do you think of this movement? Is it going to actually be able to take on the money power?
Occupy our phone lines.
Oh, yeah. Occupy our phone lines. Right.
Got a couple of calls waiting, and we'll wait for you.
Yeah. And also, were we being too hard on the New York City police? I've got about a...
And the Atlanta police.
And the Atlanta police.
And the Oakland police.
And let's hear it for the Detroit police.
Yay!
And let's hear it for...
Woo!
Mayor Bing, when it comes to this, who we're going to bash later in some other regards.
At least he's doing this.
Because Detroit, and I was saying earlier, has been a model of how police can relate to inconvenient public displays of disapproval of government policy, or how wealth is impacted, or how the 1% control all our lives, or how all the banksters should be in jail, or, all right, starting to get cranked up. Now, if they can do it in the D... Why is the Oakland police shooting off projectiles that almost kill a Vietnam vet?
Yeah, fractured his skull, and it happened to, wait, the Iraq vet was the skull. What happened to the Vietnam vet? There have been two now.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
There was another
incident. A guy in Oakland.
But you know what else? Where was that article? Atlanta is going to try again.
Yeah.
And when are they doing that again? I think it's tonight, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
Yeah, so right now, as we speak, the park closed at 11 o'clock Eastern time. I imagine there's probably something going on down there.
And I hate to do it, but we got to talk about Herman Cain.
Oh, I know. We really haven't talked to him, but he's the hot topic issue.
Hey, I got the correct
tool. Oh, my gosh. I like that.
Yeah. We haven't talked to him.
Sometimes.
Yeah,
but we haven't really talked about him. He's been a juicy story this week.
Huh? Yeah, which at some level is, who cares?
Who cares about the sexual harassment charges?
But
that he lied?
Yeah, But I think there's some interesting things. We'll talk about that when we come back, and we'll get your calls. Here's the number.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Shopping for a new TV? Fun.
Yay!
Shopping for new tires? Not so fun.
Yay!
So to make it better, Bell Tire gives you the lowest tire price, period.
Yay!
At Bell Tire, we shop the competition every day, so you can be sure you're getting the lowest tire price, period. We'll even show you our competitors' prices right at the counter, so you can see for yourself. Plus, we offer a tire installation package that includes services other places can't, at any price, like free alignment checks, nitrogen inflation, lifetime tire rotation, and more. For the lowest tire price, period, head to Bell Tire. It's not your usual tire shopping experience. It's
Bell Tire.
Better at every turn.
Bell Tire, with over 80 locations, they're in your neighborhood. For the Bell Tire near you, call 888-GO-BELL or log on to belltire.com. Hurry to Bell Tire today.
Trojan Man.
Attention, pleasure seekers. Trojan bearskin condoms are bringing couples closer than ever before. At an amazing 40% thinner than our standard condoms, just listen to what this couple has to say.
The irresistible
closeness and
amazing
sensitivity
allow us
to feel
more
connected
than ever
before. It's like we become one.
Wow, can't get much closer than that.
Get irresistibly closer with Trojan bearskin condoms. Triple tested quality from Trojan, America's number one most trusted condom brand.
Can't wait to get it on.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. If you're on hold, just wait and we'll get you on the air real quickly. We were talking about a letter, actually a snail mail letter of all things. Usually we get email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Also, the Occupy movement, you know, you folks haven't commented on it that much.
No, I've gotten some good response from it.
Some. What do you think? Huh? Good, bad? They ought to pack up their tents and go home and leave it all to the 1%. They've got our best interests. I don't think anybody believes that.
Well, unless they're sheeple who are watching the wrong news channel.
Yeah. But we had some emails?
Yeah, I got an email from Brian in Windsor. He wanted to make a quick comment about the snail mail that we were just talking about. He said, being a male, I can't say this from experience, but he's assuming even though a proper abortion is safe, it's probably not the most pleasant experience overall for most women. So if any woman wants to use it as birth control, then it's her choice and it's nobody else's business. Agreed. With possibility the exception to that going to the dad. If he's her significant other. He said, we now have over 7 billion people on this planet. So is anyone out there actually worried about the human species becoming extinct? Thanks, guys. And he said, great show as always. Thanks for writing, Brian.
Speaking of the show, the Republican show, this, I don't know what you'd call it, the sort of a variety act or a circus is coming to town. This the Republican debate.
Oh, I know.
Is coming to Oakland University.
And this is
on Wednesday.
Wednesday night.
6:30, and it's going to be Occupy Oakland, so there's going to be a big protest rally out there. And
you're going to go there. I'm going to try to make it, too.
I don't know. I want to bring a sign, as I said, that says Kane.
Herman Cain.
Herman Cain, 999, which is the number 9, the number 9, the number 9, which is this cockamamie tax plan of his that would benefit the wealthy. What a surprise, huh? And hurt the middle class, and particularly the poor. But
Peter, he tried to come here to Detroit and stand in front of the train station and say that he would exempt people in poverty because he had to backtrack because he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about.
No, he doesn't. But as we were saying, I think probably last week, that I was going to put up a sign that said Herman Cain 999, but the German, N-E-I-N-N-E-I-N-N-E-I-N.
Yeah. I like it.
And also, since he's a creature of the Koch brothers, the billionaires who finance the right wing, of which there wouldn't be a right wing. There wouldn't be a Tea Party if there wasn't these billionaires paying the bills. And setting up these organizations, what do they call them? AstroTurf organizations. And paying.
I've never heard that.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
What's that?
Well, it means a fake organization set up, like Americans for Prosperity. That's one of their groups.
Oh, and so, you know, sounds so nice, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you would think, oh, all these ordinary people got together, and but again, it's
hell no.
So the reason that they're doing it is because they don't have any troops, because they represent 1%, or actually the Koch brothers are the 0.1%, mm-hmm. and you can't make a movement out of that. So they've got to get these kind of find some social issue or anger issue.
Yeah, to wrap themselves around.
Right. So anyway, Herman Cain was accused after, and what did he think? That nobody was going to come after from this? There was a couple of settlements when he was the CEO of the National Restaurant Association.
For sexual harassment.
And there were these settlements for, or was it an agreement? He was, that was his first little dance.
Agreement.
And I mean, he had, I mean, for one thing, that you would have thought someone would have said to, look, Herman, we got to know everything that could possibly hurt you.
Skeletons.
Skeleton in your closet. What did he say? Oh, there isn't any. And then, oh, yeah, I forgot about the one where a couple women, maybe it's up to three now.
Oh, yeah.
Accused him of sexual harassment. But that okay.
The one where he had to pay something like $50,000. Give her the one a year's salary.
And you could tell that this guy really needs a little anger management course. And
because
all
you can tell he's kind of holding it all in, isn't he? Yeah. And you and I don't really care about
He's a sideshow. Well, I care. Well, that's what I do care about. When people use either their gender or their power, you know, in terms of men, to make a woman feel uncomfortable at work. And I would, you know, a lot of times, guys, I haven't heard this in a while, but they say, I don't know what to say to a woman. You know, I'm afraid if I say one, if I tell her she looks nice. And I think, why the hell are you telling some woman she looks nice? Do you ever tell a guy he looks nice? I do. You know, by the way, I've got such a strict regimen about that.
Yeah.
That,
tell me I look nice.
Well, we're pals.
I know. That's
but
true.
I would never tell another woman here that she looks nice. You know that?
Yeah, I know. You would not do that. You're right.
But I have told our general manager how sharp he looks. You know, he's a sharp dressed man.
Yeah, he sure is.
One of our favorite salespeople, Milton.
Oh, yeah.
Chris? I mean, do you know Chris?
I don't know Chris.
Chris, sharp.
Yeah, these guys wear some nice suits.
So I tell them they look sharp, but I don't want to get
a woman.
And when I used to before I did the majority of work at home from here, I used to be I was a public affairs director for the greater media stations.
I mean, you still are,
Yeah, but I don't have a. They said when we moved to this new building, do you want a cube? I said I don't need one. So anyway, but I used to be surrounded mostly by women salespeople.
Uh-huh.
And they were a raucous bunch.
I know. Well, we all are kind of, especially in this business.
I would say zero in response.
Yeah, that's how you are.
To the
You're
point,
good at that.
To the point where they would joke that I was like uptight or.
Like, loosen up. Worthy.
Because you know what? You'd say, she does have some big ones or something like that. And, 6 months later, you're sitting in a witness chair. Mr. Werby, did you comment that the breasts of my client were, big ones, you know? So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that's going to happen. Maybe I'm a little over paranoid. But I would say, guys, just stay away from there. And you know what? A lot of times guys take any sign of, not even affection. What can I call it? Of, a woman smiling at you sort of like an invitation.
At me?
Yeah. So, all right. So that's just my advice. But the other thing that's really sickening is that, Herman Cain himself said this was, this exposure of what he in fact did. And remember what they did with John, what was the guy running for president on the John Edwards.
Oh, Edwards,
yeah,
right.
John Edwards. That, talk about skeleton. There it was. And there's a skeleton.
That was a big ass skeleton.
Yeah. And maybe you could say that they just shouldn't be pulling this stuff out for any candidate, but they do for all candidates. And to say that it was racially based, like Herman Cain did, or these slime ball white conservative pundits, the talk show hosts, the what we used to call very impolitely the right wing bitch from hell.
Oh yeah, AC.
AC. Yeah. Uh-huh. And, of course, Rush Limbaugh, you don't even get to hear about him anymore. I mean, good riddance to bad rubbish, but
no doubt.
He was saying the ugliest racial stereotypes they can to attack a black conservative.
And then they compared it to Clarence Thomas.
Yes. Now, Clarence, now this really was a poor mistake on their part. Now, people, you may not remember this or you may not know of it from history, but 20 years ago, when Clarence Thomas, who's now a sitting Supreme Court justice and African American, a far right wing guy, they don't get much farther right wing than that.
Yeah.
Guy is, and he is all tied into these billionaire Koch brothers. He goes to their seminars. I mean, doesn't even give the appearance of any impartiality.
Right.
So, during his hearings, to whether they're going to seat him or not. This woman, this Anita Hill, came and said that he had made all sorts of sexually suggestive remarks to her, and he completely denied it, called it a high-tech lynching. I mean, the idea that questioning somebody's suitability for being on the high court, which he is absolutely unsuited to be, by the way, that no judicial temperament. He was rated very, very poorly by the American Bar Association. And it was just like, you know, this party of racists, the Republicans, it was like some perverse trick on the part of Bush Sr. to put in the seat of one of the giants of the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall, who had previously been the head of the NAACP, and replace him with this lightweight, Clarence Thomas.
Yep.
Anyway, so Anita Hill, what she was saying was obviously, on the face of it, true. Why would a woman come and make these things up? And the things
she herself in a national face like that.
And the things that she said rang so true. And now there's a book out saying that in fact Clarence Thomas, remember one of his ex-girlfriends say that he was addicted to pornography. All he did was make sexually suggestive remarks all the time. It is just like Clarence Thomas.
Yeah, right. They're right.
Yeah. But in fact, this is a great issue of The Nation magazine. It's called, it shows a silhouette of Anita Hill, who's now a professor. Isn't she of, like a law
she
professor
is.
Or something?
Yeah. She went back to her old job.
Right. And, that she had, she was in
L.A. or?
I can't remember where. But anyway, she, The Nation magazine says, we still believe Anita Hill, and it just has all of these essays.
Too.
Yeah, yeah.
What can I say?
So the Supreme Court Justice of the United States is sitting there only because he was a successful liar, and sexism was really what triumphed there. That, in other words, the senators, including Joe Biden, didn't believe Anita Hill. And nobody, I mean,
I mean, why would she make up something about a pubic hair on a coat can? Hello.
Yeah. And what?
A law professor.
Yeah.
Duping to that level.
Yeah. And, isn't that a guy thinks there's a hair on a can of Coke and he's, I think there's a pubic hair. That's such a guy thing. But, so Herman Cain, it wasn't like they fabricated something about him. You could always say, well, Anita Hill said, Clarence Thomas said,
She said.
Yeah, but he, being Herman Cain and the National Restaurant Association, settled with tens of thousands of dollars for these people. So why not get back?
Get back, Jack.
Yeah.
Go away. Open up another pizza chain. You seem to be good at that.
I heard the pizza's terrible.
Godfather's?
Yeah.
I used to eat it in my hometown.
How was it?
It was all right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's not great.
We have got so many people waiting, and my apologies to
all. Get
on
it, Peter.
Yeah. The number is 313-298-9743. Sorry, I'm stealing your line.
That's okay. Anytime.
First caller. Here is Greg in Auburn Hills. Greg, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Howard, Peter, and Jolene. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, not bad. I'm not getting far off the beaten path, but the thing that bothers me about city government or county government is that whenever these places get into a money situation, the first things that get cut are the police department and the fire department.
Well,
and I don't understand that. I mean, you know, and then right under the caption of that, you know, I seen, oh, the city offices are almost done.
You mean they're building new ones?
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Well, you know what happened? I'll tell you. Some of those city halls were built with stimulus money from this first stimulus, and that could not have been used for instance, keeping on.
Was ours built with
Our city hall was where the suburb where Jillian and I lived in separate residences, right. We should tell people.
I remember that one guy who thought we were married. I said, did he think we were married?
I think so. But anyway, here is the real problem. I think you've hit it, Craig. I mean, I think why there was a movie called Sophie's Choice where what's the famous actress's name?
Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep had to decide of which child to allow to be killed. And that's what we're faced with. Well, do we want to get rid of garbage pickup, or do we want to get rid of a fireman? Do we want to get rid of somebody that's doing code enforcement, or do we want to get rid of a police officer? Why in the world, in the wealthiest country in the world, do we have cities that are going broke? And that's what the Occupy movement is looking at.
Partially.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much. Peter, appreciate your call.
Someone named Pete in Garden City wrote in. Hi, Pete. He said, Peter, you're a man's man, and that's a cool thing. I don't know what that means, but I like it.
Yeah. They saw my new dog.
Oh, right, exactly.
Let's not go there.
I won't tell.
All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Freedom in Flint. Freedom, you're on the air.
Hi. Oh, hi, guys.
Hi.
I'm really happy to hear you guys talking about the occupation, first of all. You know, you really don't get a lot of that in the media. But I'm calling to let you guys know that next Friday on the 11th, all day, of course, every day there's stuff going on in Flint, but we're having an open invitation to all retired and active military personnel to come down to the base camp between 4 to 7. It is on the corner of 2nd and Martin Luther King Avenue. For donuts, coffee, good discussion, and all day beyond that, they're going to be the Bank of America downtown. They're going to have an open mic and a poetry slam contest.
Are we talking Flint here, Freedom?
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, okay, because you got the same street. So, well, a lot of MLKs.
Oh.
Yeah.
I know. There's streets the same all through the whole.
Yeah, direction. Because there's an MLK in 2nd. In Detroit as well. But so you're talking Flint. I'm sorry, I did interrupt you, but let me get a little basics in here. How long has the Flint, Occupy Flint, been going on?
They've been going on since October 14th.
Really? Wow.
Yep, and they've had private property donated to them. They've got the city okay, and it's wonderful. It's open 24/7 for anyone to wander in and ask questions. They've got a little media center going, live stream, you know.
Great. Let me ask you another question, because I know a woman who's trying to remember now whether her legal name was actually Freedom. Is that something you call yourself, or is that your legal name?
Oh, that's my birth name.
Really?
I love it. You must have had hippie parents.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
How'd you guess?
Well, you know what?
Crazy guess.
The woman I knew was Greek, and I'm trying to think of what it is in Greek, like Eleftheria? Maybe if there's some Greek-speaking people. But that's good. What a great name.
If Werby and I ever had a kid, it would be named something like Freedom or Willow or something like that.
Yeah, you get Greek as a child in school, though.
I'm related to someone named Willow. And they have major hippie
family.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
All right, Freedom, let's go through before you leave. So this is Occupy Flint, and this is a day for veterans and active duty service people. And it's at the corner of Martin Luther King and 2nd Avenue or Street in Flint.
Martin Luther King, I think it's the Avenue.
Yeah.
I know exactly where it's at, but.
It's okay.
Well, probably the Flinters as well. Well, all right. Well, good.
Glad it's happening.
Occupy
on.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye-bye. Call back in and check in with us.
You know, there was a big march in New York City of vets and I think a few active duty guys.
Oh.
That had to do after Scott Olson, the Iraq vet who had done two tours of Iraq and then had been hit in the head with by an Oakland, California.
That was the fractured skull.
Fractured
not just
skull.
Hit in the head, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so they marched in solidarity. Oh, let me tell you another story too about the Detroit police compared to these other out of control police units like the NYPD and where else? Chicago,
Oakland, Atlanta. Yeah, Chicago's really cracked.
And Denver.
Denver, yeah.
On Wednesday night, there was a march in Detroit where the in solidarity with the general strike in Oakland. And they shut down the port of Oakland. There was probably about 10,000 people doing this. So people left from Grand Circus Park in Detroit about 7 o'clock at night and were going to march to Hart Plaza in order to have a candlelight vigil. Mm. Well, people got exuberant and spilled into the street, so there we were, blocking the entirety of the southbound lane of Woodward Avenue.
Ooh.
And, you can make an argument, hey, wait a minute, come on, the cars don't have access. You can, but you know what? Again, the inconvenience to people was fairly minimal. It wasn't a huge crowd in any event. But people were very enthusiastic and very, very angry about what the Oakland police had done to this Iraq vet. So I'm looking around, and I'm expecting, like they did in Atlanta, helicopters, yeah, like they had in Denver.
RoboCops.
The RoboCops and motorcycles. No police at all. Zero.
Really?
Zero. So I'm thinking, this is too weird.
That's great.
So finally, we turned at Campus Martius and started going, I can't think of the streets. Cadillac Square or something like that. And, you know, the police probably thought, you know, wait a minute. Come on. You got this big group of people walking in the middle of the street, and this doesn't fly. This is not what's supposed to happen. Uh-huh. Again, I can understand that. And they parked their cars to block the street, so people went around the police cars, obviously.
Yeah.
And then the police said, okay, and began leading the march.
My God, that's amazing.
Blocking off traffic, so, you know, they wouldn't come into the march and all of that. And you know what? There were some people that were inconvenienced in their cars, and minimally, and for a very short amount of time. But doesn't that really work a lot better than piling into people with batons and flash grenades and motorcycles and helicopters? And you know what this cost the Detroit city, which is $150 million in debt? You know, nothing. These are on-duty, regular officers. And you could look at the men. I only saw male cops. And you know what? They didn't look pumped. They didn't look ready to kick ass.
Yeah.
They looked like, what the hell's going on? I mean, at best, you know, some of them.
Let's just make sure this goes
through. Yeah. And then we'll go home and everything will be okay. And I don't have an Iraq vet's blood on my hands.
Right, exactly.
Know. Right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we haven't been doing well with the callers. So all of you around there, Tristan and Jim and Rick and Paul and Brad, got you next on Night Call.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Do you have unfiled tax returns or owe the IRS or state more than $10,000? If you don't take action now, your tax problem is going to get worse, much worse. Seizure of property, bank levies, wage garnishments, and potential criminal prosecution. And if you owe the IRS back payroll taxes, chances are you will be visited at your home or business by an IRS agent. Don't become paralyzed by fear. Take action now. Call the experts at U.S. Tax Shield for help. Our team of experienced tax attorneys can get you protected, stop collections, and negotiate a permanent settlement with the IRS and state, potentially saving you thousands of dollars. At U.S. Tax Shield, our tax advisors will review your case for free, inform you of your rights, and give you a guaranteed quote. No games and no tricky upsells. That's why we have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and thousands of satisfied clients. Put an end to your torment. Get protected. Get the shield. Call U.S. Tax Shield now at 800-656-9393. That's 800-656-9393. 800-656-9393.
I believe I can do anything. So when it came to learning a new language, I knew I had to do it the way I learn. No books, no memorizing or translating. I wanted to learn the same way I learned my first language, naturally. That's why I chose Rosetta Stone.
Rosetta Stone invites you to be a part of its biggest language learning event in history. Because in 2011, we want to help 3 million people learn a new language. That's why we're going to give you an absolutely free demo of our language immersion technology. To participate in this free nationwide event, just call 1-800-650-4747.
Si yo puedo hacerlo, usted puede hacerlo. If I can do it, you can do it.
To participate in this free nationwide event, Call now for your free demo from Rosetta Stone. Call 1-800-650-4747. That's 1-800-650-4747.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, these braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez-Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
Jeez, Kim, it's hot as in here. What's going on?
Oh, it's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Ouch! The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet?
No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
Mm-mm, no.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you. It's straight up midnight. Well, 11:59.
Close enough.
And we will have a podcast up in about 12 hours of this show if you missed any. Also, remember our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall.
And how do they get the podcast, Peter?
I don't know.
You can go to your website. You can go to our Facebook page.
You know, wait a minute. I have not mentioned my website.
Wow.
Once.
This is big.
You know, I haven't told you and Debbie. Debbie, who's in Western Massachusetts,
helps us with the Facebook page. A lot. Thank you, Debbie.
Yeah. My website, PeterWerbe, WERBE.com, is essentially a news site, right?
True.
Yeah. I can't keep up.
A lot of links and things like that.
I am.
You can't?
Are you
going to ask her for help?
No. Okay. I'm going to not have it be a news site anymore. I'm going to have a list of the news sites I go to.
And what else are you going to do?
And I'm going to just have, you know, kind of like, what would I say, opinion pieces.
You are.
I mean, I'm sitting there trying to.
I like that.
I'm trying to, you know, thinking, oh, this just happened in Denver. I got to put this on here. Oh, this is happening in downtown Detroit. Oh, I got to, you know.
And there's not enough room for all of it, right?
And there's not only, I'm the only one putting stuff. You guys put stuff on the Facebook page, but I'm the only one doing stuff
on your website. Yeah,
Debbie helps me with that sometimes too.
Good. We got an email. We were talking about the not law yet, but they're trying to pass a law in Mississippi.
No, but it's worse than that. It's a constitutional amendment.
Right.
The Mississippi Constitution,
where they say that a fertilized egg is
a person.
Human. Yeah, and that if you do something with that fertilized egg, that and other than have a baby, it could be considered murder.
Right.
And so Jeff from GOP Hell, Indiana, said, if this new law in Mississippi passes, does that mean you can claim this fertilized egg as a dependent for another tax deduction? And does that egg qualify as an additional child, thus making you eligible for additional food stamps? I don't know what. Once again, the GOP dumbasses have thought this out really well.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeff.
And I wonder if it'll pass.
Probably. God.
Yeah.
It's the South. It's the good old South.
Here's Brad in Romulus. Brad, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Pete, Julene, how are you tonight?
How you doing?
Brad, good. Hi.
Good. Well, I hope that law don't pass down South.
My God.
Because, I mean, you know, if if it's a rape victim or if it's a woman who has been in incest issue, she has a right to an abortion. Absolutely. Emergency medical procedure.
Every woman has a right to an abortion. Remember, it's a law.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
However, in my opinion, Julene,
mm-hmm.
if you have sex
yeah.
and get pregnant,
mm-hmm.
and it's an oops, well, you have a responsibility.
To do what?
To mother that child
mm.
or to give that child up for adoption.
Okay, you know what? No, no,
no. Well, for one thing, that's
no,
the,
I don't.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't. But you, I mean, you can try to tell me that, but I, in fact, don't.
Well, here's the thing, Brad. You have the right to your opinion.
Yes.
And
you have the right to not have an abortion.
But
oh wait.
But also, but when you start having men, and it's
telling me,
yeah, men who pass the laws that are asking then the police that are mostly men to enforce mm-hmm. it. It's kind of a strange set of affairs, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, this Mississippi law makes no accounting for rape or incest. In fact, I saw this
yeah.
woman today who was head of the group that was sponsoring it was saying, we will save the little babies that are another victim of rape.
My God.
All right, Brad, thank you very much. And, you know, someone...
Can you imagine?
What's the thing? Keep your laws off my what?
Keep your... What? U.S. out of my uterus?
What? I guess it's...
That's a Julene Jordan original.
Okay. Oh, okay. But they say, keep your laws off my something or other, you know? So, you know, here...
Off my back?
Maybe. Oh. But the conservatives who talk about endlessly about not wanting regulation of corporations, of...
Right. What happened to that?
Coal-fired plants spewing out poisonous
yes.
effluents.
Killing people that way.
Yeah. They say, well, I want the government to intervene and make the decision for the woman. And in fact, if you try to do what we don't want you to do, we're going to make you a felon.
Yeah, how about that? Nice.
Yeah. All right, here is Paul. Paul's in Sterling Heights. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello to my host. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Hello to our listener. How are you?
I'm well. I got an idea to kill two birds with one stone.
What's that?
I like. Okay. Number one, you know that the United States Postal Service could be in really bad shape because a lame duck GOP Congress forced through a law that said that they have to fund their pensions 75 years into the future.
Right. That's why they're facing a so-called financial crisis. There is no financial crisis at the post office except one that was manufactured by the Republicans. Yeah.
Okay. Here we go. How about if you don't have the time to get down to an Occupy, you can protest because we all get a number of credit card applications prepaid return envelopes.
Right. You've seen this online, right?
Yeah, and it's a great idea. If you blank out the barcode at the bottom of the envelope with a Sharpie, that makes it into true first-class mail, 44 cents. You can mail back the envelope just sealed, okay? You could put something like a piece of a roofing shingle into it because a rigid envelope costs more for postage, and the piece of roofing is pretty heavy.
A piece of roofing. This is original.
You could put the rest of the paperwork that came in the envelope, I mean, with the prepaid return postage.
Okay, I've done that before.
You can mail that off. You could put, like, a lot of weight into that envelope, and that would occupy the bank, not like people occupy it, but occupy the bank with just, you know, having to pay for the extra postage, and look where the postage money is going.
Well, that's not a bad idea. I'll tell you, Paul, if you go to my website, Peter Werby, .com, W-E-R-B-E. It is it is in fact right there. All right, thank you. In fact, let me see. Can I?
He's an idea guy, right?
Yeah,
there.
Let me see if I can play a little bit here. Yeah. Here it is.
You get a lot of junk mail. I do. Most of the junk mail I get is unsolicited credit card offers. And up until Occupy Wall Street, I used to just toss these in the bin unopened. But Occupy Wall Street got me thinking. These offers are from the same financial institutions that ruined our economy by speculating on the housing market. This isn't junk mail. This is an opportunity for a dialogue.
So it's about 5 minutes long, but it's a very interesting.
Check it out, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's at Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and it is under the heading of how to screw banks a little, which have been screwing us a lot.
Uh huh. That sounds about right.
Yeah, that's about good. So, more callers. 313-298-WRIF.
Couple of open lines, if you would like to call
in. Here's Tristan in Dearborn. Hi, you are on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter and Jelaine.
Hi.
Hi.
First, I'd like to say, on the comment for the snail mail, Jelaine, in your defense, most guys with the name of Todd are egotistical, self-centered douches.
What is the deal with that name?
Well, I actually have a best friend named Todd, and by far, he's like a brother to me.
Okay.
And everybody else I know by the name of Todd are just exactly like him.
Wait. Hold on 1 second here.
And I'm getting really sick of guys named Todd. You know, yeah, it's just a goofy name, okay? Hi, what's your name? Todd. I'm Todd.
Well, I don't, on the other hand, in defense of all people named Todd,
yes.
I think it's kind of a cool name. Actually, who ruined it was
Todd Palin.
Who's Todd Palin? Oh, yeah. What was that woman's first name? What was her name? What?
Hello.
What?
Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
We got off track there a little bit. Go ahead.
Yeah.
The actual reason that I was calling was last night I had the honors of attending the Marine Corps birthday ball for the Marine Wing Support Group 47.
Okay.
And during the conversation with a few of the Marines and that, they were actually talking on the Occupy Detroit.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. Now, one of them did say that they were going to go down there to support and everything, which actually I love. I mean, the Marines go down to show support for everything that's going on. And they were also talking about the general from, I believe it was Oakland. He was the vet that got his head cracked.
Yeah.
Yes.
By a vet, an Iraq vet who had been through two tours of duty in Iraq, came by unscathed, and then went out to Oakland to use his citizens' constitutional rights and gets severely wounded.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that so many of the people that fought in Iraq received were these head injuries, like 30,000 of them or something. Yeah. So go ahead.
Yeah, and the two-star general that was there last night had commented on it, and what amazed me was the fact that he came right out and said that the biggest thing is that there was no way to treat somebody who went out and willingly laid their life on the line for our rights and for us to be able to do what we do. And he believes that it is bullshit.
You said the bad word, dude.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just kind of slipped out there.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but he says that it's bull. I'll go that way.
Bull hockey.
Bull hockey.
Yep. Todd.
Well,
the police were going that route to where they could mirror the lovely Detroit police for our protest.
Well, what we got to ask is, who authorized the arming of the Oakland police with that military weaponry that you would expect would be more appropriate if you were facing an armed insurgents? Or in Denver, where the Denver police actually felt they had to come out there with assault rifles and began pointing them at people. That's what we, why do we have a militarized police force in this country? When we don't need it. And people talk about what kind of expenditures are there. You know, you say, well, you know, what about, you know, there's a lot of times these criminals have these sophisticated weaponry and they might have body armor. Okay, you can have like a little SWAT squad for that, but you don't bring them out against unarmed protesters. And I always say, you know, 20-year-olds in shorts and flip-flops.
Yeah, playing drums in the middle of a drum circle.
All right, Tristan, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
We were talking about the whole abortion issue, and Daywan Ron wrote in. He said, how about keep your laws out of my pants? And he said, ha ha, I hope you both had a great weekend. Thanks for another great show. Okay.
You bothered to read that?
Yeah, I did.
Sorry, Daywan.
Do you want that 30 seconds back of the show?
Yeah. Now, here, I would think that almost every active duty and veteran would be in some way responsive to the Occupy movement. Get this. Under orders to cut the Pentagon budget by more than $450 billion over the next decade, which I agree with 100% and think that is nowhere near enough, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is considering reductions in spending categories once thought sacroscant. In other words, you couldn't do it. Especially, are you ready for this?
What?
Especially in medical and retirement benefits.
They're going to cut that.
They're going to cut the veteran
instead of arms or things like that.
Or take some of our troops out of the
home.
You know 700 bases around the world. I mean, this is what is in store. This is part of the race to the bottom. And many of you who joined the military thought, well, listen, I'm at the front lines of you fill in the blank, whatever it makes, you know, whatever you think your task was over there. And for this service, I will be taken care of in the manner that one would think a grateful nation would.
Yeah,
instead, they are talking about cutting medical and retirement benefits for veterans.
Or
for
God.
Yeah.
I mean, that is absolutely horrible.
This makes no sense whatsoever. Let's see. Here is Rick and Adrian. Hey, Rick, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for the opportunity, for giving me the chance to talk to you and all your listeners. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I'm addressing something tonight, which I will admit is a bit extreme and controversial.
Wow.
But I believe that if this is something which is true, it could have a profound effect for the human species. Now, I came across something online that claims to be a complete manual on how to make the Philosopher's Stone, and it's called the Book of Aquarius. Now, the person is an anonymous person, and they're giving it out for free, no copyright. You can download the PDF. I just came across this thing, and I got to tell you, this has got to be one of the most eye-opening books that I have ever came across.
Does it come with, what is it, Kenpo knives, too, or what is it?
Ginsu knives,
yeah. Hey, what do you mean the Philosopher's Stone, how you can turn, like, lead into gold?
Actually, now it says here specifically, the Philosopher's Stone is energy concentrated and purified to a massively high degree. Now, this is the same energy that you're taking in when you breathe and when you eat and drink. It's basically purified and concentrated chi energy. It's the idea that that all things have a seed, and if you can attract that seed and let it grow, as in the stone, then you can allow yourself to live for hundreds and maybe even thousands of years. Now,
he
talks faster than Tom Hartman.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Rick. Would you feel that I'm being disrespectful if I just said this is nonsense?
I don't know if this is true or not.
Well,
now, what I'm saying is,
you've heard it here. It's nonsense and not true. All right, thank you.
I mean, we're all into things like chi and...
Chi, yeah.
Yeah, man.
I mean, we talk a lot about chi in Tai Chi.
Yeah.
Tai Chi that I've done for a long time.
Absolutely.
But, you know, when I say to people, when I teach Tai Chi, I say, you know, you can either see this as sort of metaphoric, you can see this as just sort of biomechanical energy, or if you really want to think of it as this internal force that's coursing through the body that you're by disciplined practice, you're able to mobilize, all right, as well. But, you know, if somebody said to me, gee, that's nonsense, I'd go, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know. You know,
believe what you want, right?
Yeah.
As long as it's not harmful.
Yeah. I mean, it's part chi, it's like Parcheesi.
Who's played that in a million years?
But where was I? Oh, yeah, cheap. I mean, it is part of the paradigm of, like, Chinese medicine and a lot of the martial arts. And,
right.
and all of that. And you could say that it's either sort of metaphorical or it is just biomechanical energy. But when, I guess I was going to say like an acupuncture and stuff like that.
Same thing.
You could say it's all just physical. But whatever.
Yes. That was interesting. Okay.
Thank you. You're being nice.
No, I was talking about what the guy said.
Oh.
I was following what you said.
Here's Bill and Romeo. Bill, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Going good. Hey. Thanks for calling in.
Good. I have a quick question for Julian.
Okay. Julian. It's okay.
Julian. I'm sorry, Julian.
It's okay. I'm used to it.
Yeah.
I'm sure you are. At what point do you consider abortion murder?
Never.
Never?
Nope.
What if it's out of the womb?
What do you mean out of the womb?
Out of the womb?
I mean, what if it's born?
Oh, yeah. That's...
Why, you can't abort a born baby.
Exactly. So at what point do you consider 9 months, 3 months, 2 months? When does the line get drawn?
Well, there is.
I'm pretty much down with what the doctors go with here in the United States. Yeah. Cutoffs. I'm down with the cutoffs. Yeah.
There's legal restrictions on when the last point is. Where one thing, I mean, if you start trying to abort a baby at 8 months, you probably kill the mother and the baby.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
too.
but those are questions that the majority of women that have abortions, the millions and millions of abortions that occur all around the world, have to do with reasons, actually, I would say, Bill, that are no business of yours or mine or Jolene's. They're very private decisions. I've never heard of a woman who, I shouldn't say that. I mean, I've known a couple of women. God damn, I'm pregnant again. I got to get another
abortion. Oh, gosh, don't say that, Peter.
Why?
You're going to inflame people.
Let them inflame. I don't know.
I guess that's what this show is all about. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Now, I'm curious. What is this guy's name, Peter?
Bill.
Bill, I'm curious why you ask.
I'm curious because I want to know where the fine line gets drawn, and that's where I'm curious about.
Where the doctor is comfortable.
Why are you curious?
Yeah.
And I'm curious because why? What is your reasoning why? Because we should all think independently and not just based on what other people tell us, exactly as far as government goes and other things. So why do you depend on the doctors? And I understand why, because obviously doctors have education.
Yeah, they've been trained.
Mm-hmm. For you, as an educated person,
yeah.
Why do you believe what they say? Because
rather than we get into that, how about this,
Julian? Why do
I
believe what they say?
Would you agree if you're going to
I think I'm going to believe you over a doctor, Bill.
Well, what's the reasoning?
I don't even know what you're on about.
The reasoning is that a doctor knows when it's safe and viable and, you know.
There's no, the personhood throughout, I mean, every society on Earth has a personhood attached to it when it, as you said, when it exits the womb. I mean, these nutballs in Mississippi that want to give personhood to a fertilized egg, which means, of course, it could own property, it could be sued, it could,
and charge murder.
And one of the things is, what's it to you, Bill?
Well, I mean, it's a baby because I care about...
It's not a baby. Nobody considers a fetus a baby. I mean, you can call it anything. You can call it a baby if you want, but calling it doesn't matter. It's a dependent part of the mother. And women have had abortions and have learned how to abort themselves.
Throughout history.
And had healers, abort them. And went in all the places in Latin America where it's illegal, every Latin American country except for Cuba, women have millions of abortions down there, except they're dirty, they're unsafe, they kill women, they injure women. And to have abortion illegal does not end abortion at all.
It's actually quite anti-woman, Peter. It's anti-woman, in a sense, because women will...
I don't think in a sense.
It is anti-woman, and women will suffer if you take that away, because it is, like Peter said, it's a fact of life, Bill.
So when do human rights begin, then?
Human rights? Well, when they're a human, I guess.
Well, yeah, when they exit the womb, when they can live independently on their own.
So if I was a 21-year-old male who has gotten a car accident, who is now brain dead, who is still functioning, not, I mean, say I'm in a coma.
Yeah.
And I'm dependent on the machines that keep me alive.
Okay.
Whose hands do I put my life in? Because
your own, because you put them in your own because you fill out paperwork and you make sure that you're prepared for that in case you're in a coma and you say, I don't want to live this way. If I'm a vegetable, pull the plug. And that's how you do that.
I don't even know why this is coming up when we're talking about a woman's right to privacy.
Now it all becomes about you.
You know what, Bill? You know, the Roe v. Ray,
Roe v. Wade.
Thank you. It's easy for you to say. It wasn't based on a woman's right to abortion. It was about a privacy case to get the government out of the lives of women that on medical procedures.
Well, your other caller described a woman who had accidentally gotten pregnant, and she had accidentally gotten pregnant. And then, I mean, at what point does her privacy become the baby's privacy as well? Because
I think we've gone through that. Legally, it is when the fetus becomes not a fetus any longer, but a human being. I mean, everybody says that. Every woman who's pregnant said, you know, my baby's inside of me and all of that. On the other hand, what was the final figure? I forgot there. I mean, hundreds of millions of women be so uncaring that they could kill their baby. Well, obviously.
I don't think they look at it that way.
Yeah, they obviously don't conceive of it. And if you want to do it, that's your biz, but you don't have any right trying to get a political system through the legal mechanism, which involves the police and the courts, to enforce your religious or your biological views.
Yeah. And the fact that people, especially men, spend so much time thinking about, you know, what's going on up in my uterus, it blows me away. Find something more important. Why don't you focus on yourself and focus on something man-related?
All right, Bill. Bye. We blew you off. Here's Robert in Garden City. Robert, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter.
Yes.
Peter for president.
All right.
Howdy, sir.
I'm good.
Have a lot of respect.
Good.
Been listening to you for years.
Thank you.
He's been on for years.
Barely alive. Getting by on Social Security, barely.
Yeah.
Things are bad, bad, bad.
Yeah, well.
Bad.
Yeah.
Real bad.
Well, at least you're still laughing, man.
You know, you could make me laugh.
Sunday, I wait till 1 o'clock just to listen to you.
Well, that's good. You know, Robert.
Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Police. System. Take from the poor.
Like a poet.
Give to this capitalist pigs who got the whole world mad at the United States. Tested a missile way back when in Alaska. North Korea, still angry. United States, told them, get rid of your nuclears. North Korea fired a missile into Alaska. It landed. It didn't have a warhead. Okay, but it did come. But worse than that, human rights and poverty all over Michigan with the big corporations, Detroit Diesel, cut me loose. I was making $22 an hour with the blessing of the government. It was a union shop.
Yep.
Oh, it's illegal to fire ya. Oh, yeah? Lower paid workers shoveled in. $22 an hour job, cut loose after 10 years almost. Slave work. Things are bad. Policeman pulled me over. I got a lucky break the other day. God is looking out for me.
Robert,
this is phenomenal.
That's a lot for us tonight, but thank you.
I like the last part the best.
Yeah. Thank you, Robert. Appreciate it.
Oh, my.
Okay, here's Jeff from Northville has some advice on how to save the economy. That's good. We need it. What's up?
Hey, hi, Peter. Hi, Julian.
Hi.
Hi, why couldn't they use that $800 billion or bailout, the first one, and then another $880 billion for the second one? Total that out is about $1.7 trillion. Why couldn't they divide that out to back then there was 300 million people, census, I think at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the available taxpayers, if you take out the people that's getting already government funding or on welfare, and people that's already retired and collecting pension and collecting Social Security, divide that all out into about 150 million people, that would be $11,333 that they could give each individual available taxpayer, including the people on unemployment. And if they were to do that, they could actually go ahead and say, if you're backlogged on your mortgage, you could go ahead for like 2 months, $5,000 automatically has to go to paying your mortgage. The other $6,333 could go into the stock market, evenly divided. And then if they were to do that, you can't take it out for 10 years unless, depending on how old you are, they could put in like a percentage that you could take out so much after, you know, 4 years or whatever.
You've been thinking about this, haven't you, Jeff?
Yeah, a lot.
I'm afraid
I post it online, but it's even more in depth.
Well, before you get too much in depth, let me just say that that it's not a matter of good ideas, and now a lot of that is good ideas. But what there's not even political will. It's that the 1% have got the wealth. They bought off the whole political system. It's corrupt through and through. The stock market shouldn't even exist as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's just kind of a crapshoot floating around in air.
Yeah. And they have no intention of changing it. I mean, you can't come to them with good ideas. That's what we talked about earlier in the show, about confronting the money power in a manner that hasn't been done in 100 years. And that's the importance of this Occupy movement. And I'm not trying to say that good ideas shouldn't be there, because people have to have some vision, have to have some demands, or, you know, some way to reconstruct the world that it sort of benefits the 99% and not primarily the 1%. I mean, actually, I think it's lower. I mean, but you didn't want to have a movement that was called the 60% or something like that. You know,
it's not as sexy, right?
Yeah. All right. Keep those good ideas flowing, Jeff. I appreciate it.
We got an email, Peter, from Steve, who it's titled Police Militarization. Come on, Werby. The police were armed with military weapons in the name of the drug war.
Yeah, well, there's some of that. But I mean, to bring people out, there's a number of reasons why city administrations employ police in these militarized units.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they say usually, well, you know, what if there's like super armed, crooks? And you could have provisions for that. But to call them out against protesters is really horrible. And I mean, it's such an inherent violation of people's constitutional rights. Because you say, well, what if they fight back? You know, cops are big guys, usually. I mean, there's some women.
They're scary, and I've been, you know, pretty scared.
No, I'm talking about your average police officer.
Yeah.
You know.
We've had a couple in here, man. Remember that one?
Oh, well.
That guy was gigantic. No, because he was helping me.
Yeah, I know. So, right. And if he is told by the city administration that there are people out there protesting, that
park closes at 11, get them out of there.
No.
That one?
No, the opposite. That is, say, here are some citizens, and we've got a situation where, you know, there's a technical violation of the ordinance. How do we create a situation where we don't have any problems? And I'm sure Mayor Bing and the police chief of the city of Detroit, they're looking at Atlanta, they're looking at Denver, they're looking at New York, and they're thinking, man, I don't want to go there.
Yeah.
I don't want to go there.
We have enough bad stuff happening
and
here.
And so they've been really cool in Detroit, and you know what awful things have happened? Zero. And so what you have in New York, what you have in Denver and Seattle and all those places is this horrid situation. And, I mean, some of the individual police in New York, you've seen all those guys pepper spraying people and,
yeah,
doing punching people and stuff like that.
Well, the guy ran over someone with a motorcycle.
Yeah. You know, what do you need that? Well, I mean, why? And,
really?
And it doesn't serve any purpose. It creates social chaos.
Yeah.
All right. When we come back, I want to talk a little about what's happening in the city of Detroit and about the fact that Governor Snyder may appoint an emergency manager for Detroit. And if you think, oh, man, that's boring.
Yeah, well, it's
you
scary. You should be concerned.
Yeah, and we'll make it
sexy. And you know what else?
What?
This is your final chance to speak your mind for the week. So we have some open lines, 313-298-WRIF.
Yeah, one other thing, too. I don't know if this has gotten around. I want to tell you how many times during the life of a pair of Levi's, the Levi Strauss Company, thinks you should wash them.
Oh, this is amazing. Yeah.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Do you owe $10,000 or more in credit card debt? Behind on your payments or barely making minimums? Do your massive interest payments have you running like mad in circles? How long can you keep it up? Stop running. Let the Thomas & Law Group carefully plan your escape. The Thomas & Law Group has proven itself for over 18 solid years, helping thousands of people like you and me reclaim our financial future. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and offices nationwide. And the best part? There are no upfront fees at all. You won't pay a dime until the job's done. No upfront costs, no monthly fees, no banking fees. No other law firm does that. I'm a paid spokesperson, not a lawyer, and every case is different. But really, if you owe $10,000 or more in credit card debt, call the Thomas & Law Group right away for a free, no-obligation consult with a trained legal analyst at 800-460-3160. Call now, because you're tired of running in circles. 800-460-3160. 800-460-3160.
Homeowners, how do you find the right contractor when you want something built? How do you find the best service professional when you need something fixed? For any type of service for your home, go to the most trusted website for pre-screened home pros. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource that instantly connects you with pre-screened remodelers, maids, repairmen, and many other home contractors. If you need a plumber, electrician, painter, or any other home pro, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free, and it's the smartest way to find neighbor-rated contractors in your area. Over 10 million homeowners have trusted Service Magic for their home improvement and maintenance projects. So hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
101.1 WRIF. Hey, this is Lars from Metallica.
Hello, this is Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Hello, this is Brian Johnson of AC/DC. And you're listening to Detroit's home of rock and roll, WRIF.
Everything rocks.
Listen up, ladies. Right now, Bare Minerals by Bare Essentials is inviting you to participate in a special nationwide giveaway of the mineral makeup everyone's talking about. That's right. We're letting everyone who calls try America's number one mineral makeup risk-free. Just call 1-800-506-8947 to find out how. This is an exclusive radio-only offer you don't want to miss. You've probably heard about Bare Minerals Foundation. It was quoted in Glamour Magazine as a magic eraser. Allure Magazine, InStyle, and Elle Magazines, and Leaders in Beauty continue to rave about how Bare Minerals Foundation is naturally radiant and good for your skin. Now you can participate in our nationwide giveaway and see for yourself. Bare Minerals, makeup so pure you can sleep in it. Experience the foundation that started the makeup revolution. Participate in this special opportunity to try Bare Minerals Foundation risk-free. We will also send you a free gift set. Just call 1-800-506-8947 now. Hurry, you don't want to miss this exclusive radio offer. 1-800-506-8947.
Yes. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment at 1 a.m. A couple of real interesting interviews. There's a film starting at the Main Theater in Royal Oak this coming Friday called The Revenge of the Electric Car. I don't know if you remember the film Who Killed the Electric Car?
Yeah, sure.
They had about 5,000 electric vehicles in the out, and then GM said, we're taking them all back. Mm-hmm. And people didn't want to give them up, and they got court orders, and they took them all out to some desert in Arizona. Anyway, now it's, just suddenly They're happening.
It's going to be mainstream.
Yeah, and it's a documentary. Pretty interesting. Also, John Gibler wrote a book called To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War.
Yeah, it's really scary.
Yeah. Here in Detroit, Detroit proper, Mayor Bing has said that we might need a financial manager because
the emergency
financial manager. Yeah. Because, and here's the deal, if you're listening somewhere else, you don't know about this, there is a state law that's passed, and they've done this all over the country. The Republicans have put in these bills that would allow the appointment of, you know, not elected, but would allow a governor to appoint a financial manager for a stressed, a financially stressed city or a school district. And so here's what this says. Detroit, wrestling with a budget gap and a shrunken tax base, may soon require intervention from a state-appointed emergency manager to save itself from financial ruin, according to Mayor Dave Bing. Such a notion would place the city's finances and operations under the control of an appointed manager only months after, they say, Michigan's leaders, which is just all the Republicans, vastly expanded the power of such emergency managers, giving them the ability to set aside contracts with public workers' unions.
Mm.
Now, how can they do that? What happened to contracts? I thought that was meant...
It means it's contractual.
Yeah. Doesn't that mean you got to do it? So, I mean, I think this stuff would never hold up. Well, here's why the Republicans want to do it. They want to privatize everything, right?
Yes.
They want what they call outsource stuff. That means instead of people paying people middle-class wages, they get the people pay people $8 or $9 an hour. They don't have to... And remember, this is in a privatized situation, so they destroy the public sector completely. They outsource things like janitors and everything. Bus, they could even do, I suppose, fire and cops and what have you.
Sure.
They break their unions. They hire people in for $8 or $9 an hour. No benefits. This is the race to the bottom, folks. And this is why it's important. Maybe you're making $50 an hour. I mean, I don't think there's too many of you listening that are doing that. But no matter what you're making, this is all part of a vortex sucking us all down. Because say you're making either hourly, say $20 an hour, or you know, if it comes out to, you know, in a salary, $25, $30. And what's $30? What would that be? Like, I can never do the math.
I don't know why you ever do math live.
Maybe 60,000. Maybe 60,000.
Get you a big calculator.
Yeah. So you can think, yeah, what, you know, big deal. I don't care if a garbage collector gets $8 an hour. But what it means is,
I do.
Well, so do I.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, there's an ethical content here. But what I'm getting at is that everyone has a vested interest in this other than the 1% who are about all these things, like destroying unions, destroying public sector workers and all that, because the standard gets dropped down. So whereas 60,000, although that's pretty high up on the scale, it's going to say, wow, 60,000, that's a fortune.
Right.
Because everybody else is making 20 grand a year.
Yeah.
And then they're going to make 18. And then they're going to get rid of
standards.
Yeah. And then a lot of these Republicans and these libertarians want to get rid of the minimum wage. So people will be making $8,000 a year. Mm. This will still be the wealthiest country in the world, but it'll mean that, as it is now, I don't have those figures in front of me. 60% of us make below, I think, $60,000 a year.
Yeah.
Okay, the other thing is, well, I said destroy the unions, which means, one of the bases of the Democratic Party, that's what they're all about. Things are so bad, and we mentioned this the other week, now it's a big national story, that Highland Park, Michigan, where I used to live, they've yanked out 1,000 streetlights. Couldn't pay the bills.
Yeah, it's pitch dark at night, and these people are frightened.
Yeah. And it's a high crime area.
As it is. And
it was
so
a high crime area when I lived there.
And, you know, the one thing that we've learned is that illumination will actually deter crimes from happening. And so now where they've already, it's going to increase.
Republicans also put in this thing where food stamp applicants could not have a car that was worth more than $15,000.
I saw that. But then they did something where now...
They can have one car. So if you got two cars in your family, the second cannot be worth more than $15,000. What are you supposed to do? Sell it? But then if you have more
than... What if someone gave it to you?
Yeah. Well, no, you have it. Michigan has almost 2 million residents, 20% of the state's population that need help through food assistance program, including 800,000 children before you say, let's kick them off. There's probably some of you listening and say, I don't care, kick them off.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, yeah, the compassion scale is nothing you're real high on. Michigan down, by the way, to the third highest unemployment rate in the United States. That's good. And where's all the... Oh, yeah, the vehicle limit is part of a new requirement from the Republicans. It says low-income applicants must have less than $5,000 in the bank to receive assistance.
Did, okay, did this actually go through, Peter?
Yeah. So it means then they really have to become impoverished. You have to spend your last dime.
You are not poor enough.
Yeah.
You have to get poorer.
Yeah. So what happens? You live in a house, say you're lucky enough to own it, and you're actually being able to scrape together enough to pay the mortgage payment.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to get rid of that $5,000, and then you get a hole in your roof. You need $3,000 to get your roof done. Where do you get that?
Yeah.
I mean, these people are so cruel. You got to remember, you know, the Republicans are these, and not everybody who votes Republican, but the core of the Republican Party, they're these wealthy people. And they couldn't give, you know, I keep wanting to swear.
I know, it's only one of those things. I
mean, it's only appropriate.
Do I have to jump over there and press that button?
I mean, it's appropriate. They don't give a darn.
They don't give a crap.
Yeah. By the way, those of you who were worried that some of these people on cash assistance, these welfare families, mostly women and children, that maybe the court was going to hold up them getting kicked off of assistance, they're being kicked off.
Oh, my gosh.
So the more 11,000 people.
And if you don't care, I don't understand that.
But there's some nice, other nice little things here. One of the nation's most voracious consumers of trophy real estate is back on the hunt. This is Larry Ellison, third richest man in America. He's worth $33 billion, and he accumulates hundreds of millions of dollars worth of top-shelf properties around the world. And the portfolio of Oracle Corporation's co-founder includes five adjacent lots in Malibu, California, Newport, Rhode Island, mansion formerly owned by the Astor family, an historic garden property in Kyoto, Japan, and an estate in Rancho Mirage, California, with a private, his own, 19-hole golf course.
Oh, hey.
So here's a guy. So here's Detroit. Well, let's start with Highland Park. Can't afford to pay its light bills.
Yeah.
Has to put the city into darkness. I mean, isn't there something fundamentally wrong here? I mean, do you really say this is his money? That even if it was his money, why would he want to keep that? When they're talking about laying off people to the extent that that a middle class, great sectors of the middle class is going to collapse.
It's all about the bigger picture. And, you know, I tell you what, if I had all that money, Peter, you know, I'd be giving it away. And, and I hate to be your producer, but we have some phone calls, and we only have a short bit of time left for the show.
There's a lot of other things, too.
I mean, I love to be your producer.
MF Global, that's perfect, MF.
Yeah.
I never thought about that.
I didn't either.
Yeah, they're searching for roughly $600 million in missing customer money.
Maybe
they left it in their pants. Oh, we didn't tell them about Levi's.
Their
say never wash them.
Never wash them. Well, you know, we can go into that later.
Okay, we'll do that. All right, let's
we can
get
do it
the
next
calls.
Week.
You are right. Here's Jim in Canton. Jim, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
We're doing good.
You know, your political view is completely opposite of mine.
Yep.
But a few of the things you touch on, you just talked about MF Corp. If I believe right, a Democrat ran that corporation. John Corzine is a Democrat.
Right.
Right?
Well, yeah.
it's not only Republicans tearing the system down.
You took the words out of my mouth, as a matter of fact. I was going to say it, Peter. We know a lot of...
George Soros is a big push behind a lot of political movement. He's a Democrat, right?
Yeah, yeah. So
it's not only Republicans trying to tear the system apart.
Agreed.
Right? Well, no, they're part of a lot of Democrats that are very generous. You know, some of the Democratic financiers, some of the Democratic, you know, movie stars and rock stars. That's not the point. The point is there's too many people. There's too few people with too much money that have too much control over the political system. And Carzine is one of them, to be sure. But he doesn't finance screwing middle class and poor people, does he? Well, okay. You chuckle about that. We got to move on because we just got a few people.
Yeah.
Here is Jessica in Garden City. Jessica, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. sorry. I was just wanting to talk about how everything for the student loans is being messed up and gone through so many different litigations and everything else, trying to figure out what sort of budget they're going to give us. And I know personally, I'm basically killing myself to go to school full time.
Well, I can imagine. You know what? You know, this Occupy Detroit, I believe, and I'm not sure, but I think on Wednesday there's a march from Campus Martius, or I'm sorry, from
Grand Circus Park
to Wayne State with the idea of forgiving all student loans. Because you know what? College should be free. Nobody should have to pay for college. You know, and that used to be. There used to be all these colleges that didn't charge anything. There's a few that,
yeah,
that still don't.
Of, there's a name of that.
Land grant college, yeah. So,
yeah, like in California, if you're a resident for 5 years, you automatically count.
So, Jessica, this is what I tell people. You know, people say, oh, well, I'm not political or something like that. Well, you or anyone else are not political in times like this at your own peril. Not being political may mean that you're going to leave school with, I mean, you may anyway, but at least.
40 grand at least.
Yeah, but at least you would think you want to fight in your own interest. And generally, people don't know where to fight or how to fight or how can they, one isolated little individual, make any impact on anything. Well, now, finally, and I'm like, just invented overnight, this international movement that says we're tired of being screwed by the 1%. And we don't deserve to be saddled with this kind of debt in our house or in our bank cards or in our student loans. And so there's an opportunity here, to be sure.
And, I mean, I know myself, my sister, I mean, there's four people in my house who are in college right now.
Wow.
And my mom, my sister, my brother, and I. And my sister and I are actually both working two jobs plus going to school full time.
That's nuts.
Just to make the payments to go.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is stupid for a nation to do that, to put that kind of stress on people that have the kind of interest and drive to. To create in themselves someone who can contribute to society. And I don't know, did I say it was cruel? It's also cruel.
Yeah.
I said it was stupid for a nation. And it's also cruel. It'd be because, that I keep saying, this is the wealthiest country in the world. I mean, it just fought a war based on a whole pack of lies. It's going to wind up to cost you and me $2 to $4 trillion when it's all over. This could have wiped out the national debt, and this could have mean everyone in your house could have been going to the University of Michigan or wherever for absolute free. And so that's the priorities, this war state that continues. And it doesn't matter whether the United States wins or loses, some people are arguing. Well, the United States lost another war in Iraq. Doesn't matter. What it matters is the military-industrial complex continues to suck trillions of dollars out of private wealth. And that's what's happening. It's taken your private wealth, and if you're getting a student loan, who's loaning it to you? The rich, the 1%. That's who's loaning you the money. So they're becoming wealthy by forcing you to work two jobs. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Jessica. Yeah. Here is Willie in Farmington Hills. Willie, hi. You're on the air.
Hello, Willie from Farmington Hills. Just two quick points. First of all, I think that people should do their job. Detroit doesn't need a financial manager. It needs the people, city council, and the mayor to come up with a budget. It's like, why are they sitting there in the first place? But speaking of people who don't do their job, just want your comment on how you feel about signing a petition. This guy, Grover Norquist, has this petition that people in Congress are signing. And it's like, if you're going to sign
a petition,
why do we need you to do your, to do your job in the first place? Just stay home and sign some petitions.
Well, you mean the pledge, the no tax pledge?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's all the Republicans have signed on to it. And just recently, I never even got to that. The Republicans, although this is weird. I mean, this jobs bill that would have created billions of dollars for fixing. This is the Obama jobs plan, would have created tens of thousands of jobs. I can't remember even the figure. I can't find the piece right now. and it would have cost billions of dollars, and all they would have had to do was tax the rich a little more. Millionaires. They would have only taxed millionaires. Not even people making $300,000, $500,000, $800,000. Only millionaires. And that would have provided, would have been revenue neutral, would have paid for itself, and would have brought tens of thousands of jobs. And these skunks in the Republican Party just, you know, and they lost. It was like 51 to 49 in the Senate. But they can block legislation if they don't have 60%.
And they do.
All right, well, yeah, and they do.
They've blocked everything.
They did. I got to get some of these calls in real quickly. Thomas and Taylor, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing good. What's up?
Hey, I was wanting to comment on that thing about Mayor Bean, you know, talking about having a financial advisor, you know,
emergency manager.
To handle that money. Well, I was reading in the paper that Mayor Bean said that he would accept that spot, you know, if it was offered.
Right. Right. Well, go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, if he can't handle the money in the first place, how's he gonna, you know, handle the money as an emergency person?
Well, what he said he would do, in fact, people have said that he's not even serious about this. What he's trying to do is threaten the unions into making major concessions of, you know, lowering their pay, lowering the retirement benefits and all of that. But I think really, Thomas, the thing is that we're scrambling around for pennies at the bottom of society. And, you know, a lot of urban cities, a lot of suburban cities, Troy for a while, you remember they closed their libraries, yeah. Ferndale's laid off police officers. I just keep posing that over and over again. Why are we in the richest country in the world having all these problems? It's called 1%. All right, I got to move quickly. Here is Larry in Vancouver, B.C., where it's only, I don't know what, 10 o'clock. Hey, Larry, you with me? Oh, I got I got one of these phones. You got to turn it on. Hey, Larry, hi, you're on the air. Tell me quick.
Yeah, good evening.
Good evening.
Hi.
To you and Jolene, and you have a good show.
Thank you.
I have two questions. The first question is, I'm just wondering, in terms of the Occupy movement, if it's very good goals, I'm just wondering how many of the occupiers do you think will actually later on go and vote, and will this movement influence the current crop of politicians? And the second question, just recently, because I think 1 year from now there's going to be the 2012 election.
Right.
Obama, in terms of the USA Today Gallup poll, in terms of the swing states, is very low in terms of voter satisfaction, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, will he have any challengers, particularly on the left?
You mean in the primaries?
Yeah.
I didn't know. I would say absolutely not. I would love it if Bernie Sanders, the socialist senator from Vermont, would run against him, but he's not going to do it. Will they have an impact? Well, I think I've said before, is that since the goals of the teabaggers were ones that were motivated in the first place by the billionaires, they were pretty easy to roll into the billionaires' party, the Republican Party. Are they going to have an influence on legislation? I don't know. I mean, right now, the concentration of wealth and the power of money is what we're all debating. How does that translate into reform? It's not clear. Certainly, the Occupy movement so far is a protest movement. Where it goes from here beats me.
But nobody knows.
Stay tuned, as they say. Thanks for making our show international, Larry. Appreciate it. Let me see I can get another call in here. It's Joseph from West Bloomfield. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, you guys?
We're almost done, so you got to give me a couple of quick ones.
Okay, great, man. Just one thing real quick then. I was just flicking through the stations, and I've been out of state for a couple of years. Riff Rock still, man. But I turned it on hoping to hear some music, and I heard you guys. I just wanted to say that you make a comment about how you're talking about how the 1% of the most wealthiest people in America, I think, you're talking about how this one guy owns, like, these pristine properties all over the world.
And
how, I mean, I don't understand how, like, am I getting this right? Like, do you think that, like, the rich people, the 1%, should pay, like, for all the lazy people to not work and just...
Oh,
well, do you think that these...
Wow.
How many people, you know, Wes Bloomfield. Okay.
Okay.
That's it.
That's
never
all.
Mind.
We don't right. need to hear more.
Yeah.
Good
yeah.
Night.
Yeah. 20 million people. I guess they're
my
lazy.
God.
Wow. And
people have a lot of nerve.
I'm just going to end it with a cough. But I got a couple of interesting interviews ahead. Stay tuned. Athena,
yes.
Sarah, thank you so much. We'll have podcast up at noon.
And by the way, to that guy, just I know you've been gone for a couple of years, but this show has like been on here for on the Rev for like 40 years.
40 years, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Is it time for a new roof? Call Sears Roofing. You can save $500 if you call right now. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Hurry, offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Get your roofing job done right. Call Sears Roofing now. You can save $500. Call now. 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
One size does not fit all, especially when you're talking about your mortgage. Introducing the all-new Yourgage from Quicken Loans. Yourgage is better than a traditional mortgage because it conforms to your goals. In fact, it's the only home loan that allows you to custom design your term anywhere between 8 to 30 years. Here's how it works. Let's say you've got 8 years left on your mortgage and you want to refinance to a lower interest rate. The Quicken Loans 8-year fixed Yourgage can help. It keeps your term short and lowers your monthly payment. Just call Quicken Loans at 888-249-1425. The Quicken Loans Yourgage. It's a home loan on your terms. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. Nationwide licensing number 3030. Other restrictions apply. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. Call 888-249-1425. That's 888-249-1425.
Now's the time.
Now's the time to make a difference.
Now's the time to do what's right.
To help a family.
Now's the time to volunteer.
To make a commitment.
To make new friends.
To make dreams come true.
To help a child.
Now's the time to help Habitat for Humanity build hope and change lives with a family in your community or around the world.
Now's the time.
Now, more than ever, help build it.
Visit Habitat.org.
Are you an inventor? Or do you know an inventor who would like to attempt to have an idea or invention patented and submitted to industry? For free information on how to get started, call InventHelp toll-free at 1-800-762-7000. InventHelp is America's largest invention company. Their referrals have helped inventors secure more than 7,000 patents, and they can provide free inventors information for you. Find out how to record your invention's date of origination and get an informative brochure and other material of interest to new inventors. Get started by calling 1-800-762-7000. Even if you have an idea for improving an existing product, you'll want to get this free inventor's information from InventHelp. Find out how to try to patent your invention and submit it to industry. Call now to get your free inventor's information. Call 1-800-762-7000. That's 1-800-762-7000.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Pleasure to have you listen to this interview that is a follow-up to something that we did in 2006. And that was the appearance of the film, Who Killed the Electric Car? And the answer was General Motors that killed the EV1, this car that they had about 5,000 of them out. And suddenly they said they wanted them all back. They wanted them all back, and some people didn't want to give them back, and they made sure that they got them all back. It's a story in and of itself. My guest at the time was Chris Payne, the writer and director of Who Killed the Electric Car, and he has a brand new film out. It's going to open at the main theater this coming Friday, and the last one was sort of mixed. I mean, it certainly you thought, wow, the electric car and the idea of getting off fossil fuels is taking a big hit, but Chris Payne's brand new film, is called The Revenge of the Electric Car. And there's good news. It's a pleasure to welcome back Chris Payne. Chris, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you for having me on, Peter.
Yeah, so suddenly things are looking a little brighter for non-fossil fuel cars. What's the genesis of your film? When did you realize things had turned the corner?
Well, I think we talked about 5 years ago after the first film came
out. We did. We did,
yeah,
indeed.
And the main things that happened in the last 5 years are, from a realpolitik point of view, the gas prices hit $4 a gallon for the first time in the U.S. And when that happened, very few car companies had products to sell that wouldn't cost $100 to fill up at the gas station. And they thought, we cannot be in this position next time this happens. And a lot of trends show that oil prices over the next 10 years are headed up. And so it might be time to have some more products in the line. So there is national security pressure on the car companies to get off of oil a little bit, and environmental pressure, of course. So electric cars suddenly had an opportunity to come back into the market. And we weren't planning to do another electric car film, but we began to get emails from insiders, and they said, hey, you know what? I think my car company is actually doing the electric car. You should check it out. And since we had the contacts, we thought, maybe we should do another film.
And it turned out to be Revenge of the Electric Car. It's narrated by Tim Robbins. And I suppose, Tim Robbins, like you, it's not just a job. It's a crusade. That has a bad ring to it. But it's a passion. Am I correct?
Well, documentaries are really tough to make. And I think the ones that get made are ones that have the filmmakers behind them who really care a lot about the story they're telling. And I wasn't the biggest car guy in the world, but I drove that GM EV1, 10-12 years ago, and I thought, wow, this is the future of automobiles, not just because environmental reasons or something like that, but because the car is just more advanced to drive without an engine in there. It's like amazing, amazing performance. So when those cars were taken away, I thought, well, this looks like be part of my mission to try to let people know that this is worth checking out.
The brand new film from Chris Payne is Revenge of the Electric Car, and as I said, he also wrote and directed Who Killed the Electric Car. Turned out it was General Motors. Why in the world, just you have to refresh our memories, why in the world would General Motors kill the EV1?
Well, the film posits that there were like 7 different suspects involved in the destruction of those cars. About 5,000 electric cars were made in California, not just by GM, but by Toyota and Honda and Ford, Nissan. Everybody had an electric car because California kind of forced it on the car makers to deal with some of the problems of childhood asthma they're having in big cities. So the car companies didn't like this, and they began to fight this regulation. And in the end, General Motors led the lawsuit along with a bunch of other auto dealers and folks that turned the corner on this and closed the regulation down, and then they recalled all their cars. And so our film tracks the way the oil industry was involved early on in helping out on killing these cars, and eventually how everybody's a loser, because we could have used those cars when gas prices headed up, and it was a real shame.
Tell us about the focus of Revenge of the Electric Car. You really focus on 4 main actors in this, all positive. We're not trying to find a crime here. We're trying to look at the future.
Well, I kind of felt that people were a little burned out on issue movies, and let's do a film about what it takes to, get the ship headed in the right direction. And in the system we have, entrepreneurship and, whatever you want to call them, great leaders within business units of companies can sometimes make a difference. So we tracked 4 sort of different corporate archetypes. Elon Musk at Tesla Motors, a Silicon Valley millionaire who had sold PayPal to eBay and made a lot of money, and he said he was going to do it. And General Motors, who changed their mind on electric cars, and Nissan, who put $6 billion into developing electric cars, and then my next-door neighbor.
Gadget.
Yeah, Gadget.
This is an incredible film.
Most of us don't have $6 billion to start a car company. So it's I thought, there's a lot of people that have been doing this in spite of what big corporations are doing, and they're part of the story.
Well, tell us about Gadget, because we expect big car companies and a startup like Tesla, which is a story in itself, and we can get to that. And it's chronicled in Revenge of the Electric Car. It's going to open at the main theater on Friday in Royal Oak. But let's back into it with Gadget. Right, not a billionaire. How does he figure in the film?
Well, when the mandate got turned back in California, the electric car, a lot of people said, you know, we're going to go ahead and take old cars or existing cars, and we're going to drop the engine out and put batteries in, and we'll have, like, short-range cars we can make at our house. And Gadget wanted to do a 120-mile range Porsche Roadster. I think they're called Roadsters. Roadster or Speedster. That's it, a 50s Speedster. And he started off on this endeavor. Without any capital, you can only afford to do one car at a time. And so while the big guys were building these big car programs behind the scenes, Gadget was building his car in a garage with his wife.
Tell us some about the cinematography as well. It's incredible. You know that oftentimes documentaries are just, as they say, talking heads and some stills. You've got some incredibly dramatic footage, and the music is really over the top. It's actually an incredible production, and I kind of wove two elements in there, but both the cinematography and the music, which gives it presents it in such a dramatic manner.
Well, directors get a lot of credit, but we all know that films take a lot of people to make them. And David Robbins composed our music. He's a really talented guy. And we thought, you know, Bob Lutz is kind of a Mad Men type figure, so let's get a theme for him that's somewhat like Don Draper or Mad Men or something. And we gave each of the characters a different theme. And I think he did a terrific job. And our cinematography was Thad, who did our first film. But this time we had a little bit more time to really develop our shots. And the idea was, instead of doing lots of interviews, let's try to shoot the movie in a series of scenes. And so that gives the film kind of a real traditional movie feeling.
As I said earlier, Tim Robbins did the narration of Revenge of the Electric Car, and you just mentioned the composer. A relation there?
Yes, that's Tim is David's brother. And so they're kind of a dynamic duo. They, you know, they both lost their parents this year, so it's been a huge year of transition for them. And we were just lucky to get them both to help out on the project.
Yeah, and Tim, I assume as well, given his history of supporting environmental considerations, was probably pleased to do it.
He was. You know, I was a little nervous because, you know, Tim's got such a reputation for progressive causes. And this film, we really go very deep into the, you know, corporate soul of America, if you will. And I thought he might not get what I was trying to do, but he saw the film and he said, no, I get it. You know, there's people on the inside making a difference. And even if you think the system's really failed, we have to try to support the people that are making good decisions on the inside.
Well, is there a politics here? Because oftentimes I've heard some conservative commentators. I remember one time I heard one of the more popular guys say, look out, these liberals are trying to take your SUV away. And you think, wow, I'm trying to save the planet. I'm trying to get us off of foreign oil. I'm trying to get a quiet car. And someone says you're part of a liberal agenda.
Yeah, I don't know how they do the math on that. These new cars are creating tons of jobs. And every time you fill up an electric car, you're filling it up with energy that you get right here in the U.S. And whether you're an environmentalist or not, you can't be in favor of exporting $1 billion a day to Saudi Arabia and other countries, which is what we're doing. So imagine that $1 billion stays right here in the U.S. That's got to be a good thing. And I think elements on the right and the left to get a little bit into their super purist mode, and they forget like what the real objective is.
Chris Payne is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. He's the writer and director of Revenge of the Electric Car, and you may remember from a few years ago when I interviewed him, who killed the electric car? Well, the electric car is back with a vengeance. You could have, that's a nice. You could have called it the vengeance. No, I like revenge better. and you know, isn't it nice to be kind of what would you say, proven right? Right, a kind of I told you so, and in a good way, and it, how it provides, as you said, a cleaner environment and jobs. I mean, this is what we're all looking for.
I think so. You know, it was tempting, I have to say, when Hummer went bankrupt and then the Chinese didn't want to buy the brand from GM, and, oh, gosh, we're going to make a real I told you so movie. And we thought, you know, no one needs to see that. Well, I mean, we can have a little bit of that in the film and you can pick it up. But what this is really about is like, okay, let's jump in the seat with the people that are making this happening and see where we can go.
Well, tell us about some of the cars, because you mentioned the Tesla. This is a fabulous car, and it makes a wonderful appearance in Revenge of the Electric Car. And there was a big splash about it just, was it like a year ago or earlier this year? And then I haven't heard about it anymore.
Yeah, well, Tesla is, you know, they're no longer making those super hotshot $100,000, sports cars. It's called the Roadster. Because they have, retrofitted the old GM, actually it became a Toyota NUMMI factory in California, and they're starting next fall, they're building these, Model S sedans. So instead of holding two people, hold like six or people, and really, really beautiful cars. So I think they're holding back until they're actually selling these cars. And I went on a tour of the plant a few weeks ago just as a tourist, and it was a beautiful, beautiful operation. I think they're going to do very well.
And they're, though, competing against the big boys. Like
Yes, they are, and that's a big job. And, you know, their car's coming in at a higher price point. It's still a $50,000 car. But part of the rationale, if you talk to the Tesla people, is like, well, we can't make out of the gate, we can't make millions of cars like, you know, a Toyota or something. We have to ramp up. So we thought, let's start with a really high-end car, and as time goes by, we'll have less expensive cars. So that's probably a smart strategy for them.
Well, you know, it strikes me, though, even at 50,000, I can't, you know, the advertising agencies would probably hate me, but I was watching television last night and saw an ad for some Asian car that they were saying starting price was $11,000, or a little bit below 11,000. Even with all the gas you would save, you know, you can buy a lot of gasoline with $40,000 that you would save. I wonder if it, actually is competitive. Those prices.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and this is why, unfortunately, you do need government help on these things. The gasoline car took, you know, 100 years to amortize to get it down to where you could sell one for $10,000. And electric cars are new out of the gate. It's true they're a lot simpler, like very few parts in an electric car, and they never break down because there's hardly any parts and lots of things going for them. But in the beginning, they're going to cost a little bit more, and where you save, of course, is that gasoline is $1 a gallon in equivalent cost to fill up.
Now, this is electric cars are really nothing new. I'm forgetting the author's name. The book was Internal Combustion. That man's last name is Black. He did the book also on IBM. Are you familiar with that at all?
I think I might have read that a few years ago.
Yeah, a great one. And he talks about in the early part of the 20th century, it was a real contest as to whether we were going to have internal combustion engines, Henry Ford and what have you, or his buddy, Thomas Edison, who wanted the electric car. And at some point, the majority of cabs in New York City, I forgot about, you know, 1908, majority of those were electric. So why this big space? How come we've been off of electric for so long?
Well, what happened in the 1920s is, believe it or not, I mean, there's a lot of factors, but one of the factors is that generally electric cars were driven by women and by doctors who wanted to keep their hands clean for surgery and things like this. And cars that ran on gasoline were noisy and they were seen as men's vehicles. And so people wanted to gravitate to the thing that seemed to have more power and was more masculine, and when electric starters came in to make the cars a little bit less complicated to run, they just took off.
Well, Chris Payne, let me test your esoteric. You're probably thinking, oh, no. Grandma Duck's car. Do you know what that refers to?
No, what's it?
Well, this was Donald Duck's grandma, and she drove a 1911 Detroit Electric.
Awesome.
So that fits into what you were saying. That was a grandma's car, whereas us guys, man, we like that.
Like
hey, that Tesla sports car, which is probably one of the more beautiful cars ever produced, you just don't hear anything, right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, an interesting thing about the way they've marketed that car. If you look at the Tesla, there doesn't say the word electric on it anywhere. They're just like going, this is a better car. And, oh, yeah, by the way, you never have to go to the gas station. And I think in a way that's a play, you know, to the beauty of the engineering, the speed at 0 to 60 in 4 seconds or something.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I think it's the fastest production car in the world except for one of the Ferraris at the very high end. So this is like, hey, guys, it might not make all that noise you like, but check out this, and I think it's turned a lot of heads that wouldn't normally be thinking about it.
You know, Chris, I mentioned earlier about Thomas Edison. He had this idea of having, imagine how much noise this would have made, but a windmill at everyone's house that would power appliances and lights, but also charge your electric car. Now, where do people, if you have like a Volt or you have a Nissan or if you wind up one of those cars, where do you, quote, fill up?
Well, you can, you know, electric cars can plug into any outlet. It just takes longer. Like if I could plug the Tesla or the Nissan Leaf or the Volt into a wall socket in the bathroom and charge the car with an extension cord, you know, in 12 hours by leaving it overnight. So, but 12 hours is too much time for most people. So you want to, if you're lucky enough to have a garage, you put in a 220 thing like you would on a washing machine, and you can charge the car a lot faster than that. And now they have I know the newest Tesla has a 440 volt charger where you can charge a car at quote 300 miles an hour. So you could, you know, stop on a highway journey and charge your car. So this stuff's all coming. And then the next question is, where's the energy coming from?
Sure. I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, is that the question?
Yes. Absolutely. Aren't you then going to have to generate a lot of electricity, maybe with coal? I mean, does it work out?
Yeah. Another great question. In fact, it's funny. Sometimes I'll go on to I was on Fox and Friends, and you always expect them to ask you about, what about coal power? Of course, it's like the first time they seem to care about climate issues is when they can critique the electric car. But the real answer to that is the U.S. is right now 50% coal. So the cars right out of the gate are generally 50% cleaner than a gas car, because gas and coal have about the same amount of carbon molecules in them. And the idea of electricity is that over time you're cleaning it up, whereas gasoline stays consistently the same level of dirtiness. So it's not an answer to completely clean energy, but it can be over time, because as you clean up the grid, the cars get cleaner.
Now, there's a lot of people that I think initially buy these automobiles, electric automobiles, like a lot of people bought the Prius or any high mileage cars, ones that get good mileage. And yet, as a society, I think people are still going to go for the least expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I have a car that gets not very good mileage, but I got it with no interest for 6 years, and I kind of figured it out. And I'm not paying any interest on it, so I can kind of afford the higher gas mileage. And so we do that kind of cost benefit analysis. And as long as, I mean, even at $4 a gallon, what's down to about $3.35 a gallon around here, I kind of alluded to this earlier, it kind of works out to be, I hate to say it, cheaper to do the gasoline.
Yeah, you don't have to hate to say it at all. It's like we enjoy really low gas prices as a whole, and the only time people really take notice, of course, is when we have gasoline shock increases. And the oil industry as a whole would like to keep oil prices moving up as slowly as possible so people don't feel the pain so much. But unfortunately, we don't control the price of oil like we may have done at one point, certainly when oil was, you know, refined, made, discovered all here in the U.S. until the 70s. Now, anything could happen. There could be something could happen to the refinery in Saudi Arabia, the big shipping station there, and you suddenly have jumps to $6 a gallon. And in those moments, if the factories are only making 10,000 electric cars, everyone's going to be swamped. So all we can hope for is that gas prices, increase gradually, and electric cars can catch up as people say, hey, I might pay another $1,000 for an electric car because I don't need to buy gasoline.
My guest is Chris Payne on the Peter Werby Show. He was the writer and director of Who Killed the Electric Car? It's brand new film. It's opening at the Main Theater in Royal Oak this coming Friday. It's called Revenge of the Electric Car. It is narrated by Tim Robbins, and it's a success story in many ways. Is it a success story for Detroit at all? We're talking about Tesla in California, Nissan, Toyota, well, GM. We're here with the Volt. And they're being done here. But is there a Motor City connection that we should be interested in around here?
Oh, I think so, for sure. You know, I mean, whatever the Volts, you know, short-term sales go up and down, but this is a good thing for the brand. The GM's like reinventing itself as a new GM, and I think the Volt's going to help them, their perception of the company out in a lot of places that wouldn't normally think about General Motors products. Very high quality car from my experience with it. And Ford's coming out with an EV, and I know at least with the Volt, every car is being made there at the Hamtramck plant in Detroit. And the workers you meet on the line there are really proud of that car. And I think the early buyers of this car have been very pleased with it. So, you know, just because a lot of cars are made in other countries doesn't mean that Detroit can't move to the front again.
Do you drive one of those, any of the cars?
I did. You know, I traded my Prius in for a Bolt about 6 months ago. And, you know, of course, I had to pay full list price because we had to make sure not to take any money from the car companies and not to play any of their games. And I was a little skeptical at first, but I'll tell you, it's kind of nice to have a gasoline backup. So after you blow through your 40 miles of battery power, if you're on a long trip, you can go back to, you know, good old gasoline.
You know, people worry about that. I mean, we travel so much. I mean, there's some friends of mine, probably, you know, yours as well. They'll commute 100 miles in a day. So,
yeah,
one of the mixed engines. But at this point, we just can't have long range. And if so, what's holding it back?
Well, batteries is what's holding back, you know, long range, you know, cars to price the same way as we price gasoline cars. And this is why I think plug-in hybrids have a really big future in the U.S. Certainly in cities where people have shorter drive distances, and we all drive a lot less than we think we do, especially in cities, pure electrics can begin to dominate over the next 20, 30 years. But I think for road driving, you're still going to look at plug-in hybrids until we get batteries down a little bit more in price.
Got a number of interesting people here. Some of the names people would be familiar with, others not. Danny DeVito is in there, Gavin Newsom, Thomas Friedman, the columnist. Just real quickly, everybody loves Danny DeVito. What's his role in Revenge of the Electric Car?
Well, you know, I had heard that Danny had made a YouTube video about the EV1, the GM car.
Really?
So I go, what? So I look up YouTube, and there he is, and he's talking about how he got to drive one of these EV1s, and he was really upset when they took it away. And I go, huh, that sounds familiar. And someone introduced me to him at some event in Los Angeles, you know, living in Los Angeles, you run into folks every once in a while. And I said, are you really? He goes, oh, yeah, I love these electric cars. And I said, well, would you, you know, we'd love to have you make an appearance in a new film. And so there he is. He tells the story very well. He's a super charismatic guy.
Yeah, and certainly I can see where the columnist Thomas Friedman would be very much into this. He's always, in many ways, sort of a futurist almost in terms of trying to envision a new way of doing everything from business to politics.
Yeah, he's brilliant, and he really wants the United States to succeed economically. I mean, I don't think he's the biggest environmentalist out there, that's for sure, but boy, he understands what the U.S. needs to do to really move back into the forefront of you know, of power as an industrial nation and making the right decision. So I was just delighted that we got him for a quick interview.
A final question. Do you really think that there's a point, and I don't know why I put that emphasis on really, it makes it sound like it's not plausible, but do you think there would be a point at which electrics will dominate, where that they will have our gasoline engines for drag strips?
In the short run, I you know, it's important that people who can afford to should go out and test drive these things and just see that, wow, this is a car I'd rather have anyway, regardless of what it runs on. And this is the window to do it because these cars are finally available for anybody to check out. In terms of mass adoption, I think it's going to be related to gas prices. As gas prices go up, and there's more and more pressure for us to, you know, use our own energy and try to clean up the tailpipe, this will kick in. And it's happening a lot faster. I mean, consider this. I didn't think 5 years from making that first film that we'd be making this film. That's a lot of change in a very short time.
It is indeed. Chris Payne has been my guest on the Peter Werby Show, and he just mentioned his last film, which was Who Killed the Electric Car? We've gone a long way, as he said, from that. That's available as a DVD, and I'd highly recommend it. At the end of it, it shows a couple of prominent Detroiters in the innovative field of energy, Stan and Iris Ovshinsky. And Chris has appeared on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Nightline, ABC World News Tonight, Democracy Now!, Science Friday on NPR. And he's forward-thinking, as are the people putting together this electric car. The film is Revenge of the Electric Car. You can put revengeoftheelectriccar.com and get the trailer, all the information about it. And best of all, we can see it on the big screen at the main theater this coming Friday. And
we're also opening in Ann Arbor at the Michigan Theater there. And I think Bob Lutz is going to come out to sign a few of his books at one of the screenings.
From GM, yeah. Well, that's great. Absolutely. I should have asked you about Bob Lutz. That's a name that most Detroiters know as well. Chris Payne, just real quickly, we've got about 20 seconds. What's in the pipeline for you? Another documentary?
Well, I wanted to spread the word about this film because they take a couple of years to raise money for these films. And once you do them, you hope a lot of people get a chance to see them. And maybe down the road, I'll do a film about bicycles.
Okay, we'll get you on the air for that. Chris Payne, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Okay, thanks, sir.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
How do you get the most satisfaction? For some career-minded people, it's when they work toward a goal and reach it. The same may apply to you when preparing for your career. In fields like electronics technology, information technology, and drafting and design, you need knowledge and skills to get started. That's why you should call ITT Technical Institute. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Call 800-741-5123. ITT Tech's program are designed to help you develop skills and knowledge to pursue your career interest. Classes and day or evening courses meet just a few days a week, and financial aid's available for those who qualify. So pick up the phone right now and call ITT Tech for more information. Call 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123. For important information about these programs, go to programinfo.itt-tech.edu.
Is it time to replace your home's carpet or flooring? Call Sears Flooring to get shop-at-home convenience you can trust. Sears Flooring brings the showroom to you with a wide range of carpet, tile, hardwood, and laminate. And if you call right now, you'll save 20%. Call for a free in-home consultation at 1-888-491-3939. Sears Flooring has many styles to match your home and your budget. Your new flooring will be precisely installed, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. So call Sears Flooring right now and save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. Offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Call Sears Flooring. You'll save 20% if you call now. Call 1-888-491-3939. That's 1-888-491-3939. Sears.
This is your Car Care Minute. With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely. First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure, and be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now's the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
Who's watching your home when you're not there? It could be a burglar. Burglars prefer to break in when they think no one is home and no one will stop them. Don't be an easy target for intruders. Protect your home with a free security system monitored by ADT, the leader in home security. Pick up your phone now and get free hardware, free medical and fire alerts, and free activation. It's an $850 value. Just call Protect Your Home, your authorized ADT dealer, at 1-877-653-8844. You'll get 24-hour protection, and there's no cost for parts or activation. Call now about a free security system monitored by ADT. Call 1-877-653-8844. $99 installation charge, 36-month monitoring agreement at $35.99 per month. Call for terms and conditions to this offer and protect your home license numbers. Call now, 1-877-653-8844. That's 1-877-653-8844.
Listen up, ladies. Right now, Bare Minerals by Bare Essentials is inviting you to participate in a special nationwide giveaway of the mineral makeup everyone's talking about. That's right. We're letting everyone who calls try America's number one mineral makeup risk-free. Just call 1-800-506-8947 to find out how.
This is an exclusive radio-only offer you don't want to miss. You've probably heard about Bare Minerals Foundation. It was quoted in Glamour Magazine as a magic eraser. Allure Magazine, InStyle, and Elle Magazines, and Leaders in Beauty continue to rave about how Bare Minerals Foundation is naturally radiant and good for your skin. Now you can participate in our nationwide giveaway and see for yourself. Bare Minerals, makeup so pure you can sleep in it. Experience the foundation that started the makeup revolution. Participate in this special opportunity to try Bare Minerals Foundation risk-free. And we'll also send you a free gift set. Just call 1-800-506-8947 now. Hurry, you don't want to miss this exclusive radio offer. 1-800-506-8947.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. We don't hear much about the drug war anymore in this country. Almost like the concern about drugs other than medical marijuana has almost disappeared, is one thought I have. Second thought is I think about people in suburbs like myself, and particularly in one, if you're not from the Detroit area, you've probably heard of Grosse Pointe. It's a wealthy suburb. And directly west of it is one of the poorer neighborhoods of Detroit, separated by an imaginary line, as are all borders, unless it's fortified or something like that. And people in the suburbs are aware of Detroit, where conditions are extraordinarily deprived. People are poor. There's just been reported that 45% of Detroiters are functionally illiterate. The schools are a mess. The city's broke and what have you. And we're aware of that from a distance. And have varying degrees of concern. One of the things that we always are concerned about is we don't want that aspect of the area in which we live to leach over into the areas where we feel secure. Well, this is, at least to my mind, is a fairly apt analogy for what's happening in Mexico today. From a view from afar, we see this rate of murders there since December 2006. More than 38,000 people have been killed. And there's a drug war, right, to try to stop all that. There's not been any noticeable reduction in drug shipments across the border. That continues apace. A couple of years ago, I interviewed John Gibler. He's an independent journalist, been to Mexico for many, many times, has lived there. And we interviewed him about his book, Mexico Unconquered, published by City Lights in 2009. His brand new one out. It's called To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. It's going to be coming out next month from City Lights Books. You can go to citylights.com. And we're reaching John Gibler now in San Francisco. John, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks so much. Great to be here, Peter.
And also, I would direct people to a very important, to some extent, a summary of your book. It's called A War of Anonymous Death, and it's published in online in counterpoint.org, or Counterpunch, rather, counterpunch.org, I think a very necessary site. Well, what, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a question that's not too broad. I almost feel like saying, what in the world is going on in Mexico? But I think I need to be a little more specific. The violence and the scope of it and the ferocity of the way it's applied is just so horrifying. What in the world is generating all of this?
Well, what in the world is generating it is, I think we go to the roots, the insatiable demand for commodities that the state consistently insists on classifying as illegal. To rephrase that, like, the demand for drugs and how good a business drugs are when they're illegal. That is at the root, the fact that illegal narcotics are a multi-billion dollar a year cash industry. The organizations that work in trafficking and then distributing and selling those narcotics are linked in complex ways similar to those of transnational corporations moving like just incredible amounts of product and cash. And again, the illegality with the risk it implies guarantees the very large profit margins, but it also means that murder becomes becomes a kind of necessary overhead expense in the industry, since no one can go to courts or seek any form of adjudication of a conflict through institutions. Conflicts have to be settled outside of the law, and in an industry where physical cash is so abundant as to almost be a kind of burden. And arms in the United States, especially the small arms that most of these organizations prefer, such as AK-47s and AR-15 assault rifles, 50-millimeter Barrett rifles, and all sorts of 9-millimeter handguns, those weapons can be bought rather inexpensively in the United States, moved across the border easily into Mexico. Murder almost becomes the kind of most cost-effective way of settling conflicts. Now, that only gets us so far. There's
Let me interrupt you 1 second, because I think that is one of the obvious arguments against drug prohibition, and we know people that that understand how this drug war has been an absolute disaster point to the prohibition of liquor in the 1920s and what that generated in terms of crime and violence. Yet the violence was never at the level. I mean, we talk about Al Capone's St. Valentine's Day massacre, and what did they shoot, like five people? I mean, that'd be these Mexican cities would be happy if people were only getting dispatched at five at a bunch, right? What is happening that the violence is at such a level and such a toll? That's what seems so incredible.
Exactly, and that's exactly the point I wanted to get to, in that the fact that murder becomes a kind of necessary feature of an illegal transnational industry only explains so much. It explains occasional killings, gangland hits, and I don't think that explanation is enough to account for what's happening in Mexico right now and what's been unleashed over the last 4 years. And so for that, you have to look at particular facts of recent history. Felipe Calderon took office in December 2006 with the weakest mandate in Mexican history. 2006 was a year in Mexico of extreme, exciting social mobilizations, teacher strikes, indigenous marches, anti-electoral fraud movements. Indeed, the federal presidential elections that year were marred by allegations of electoral fraud. According to the official federal numbers, Felipe Calderon won by less than half a percentage point over his rival, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. So he entered into office in a country where the presidency had historically been passed down as a kind of heritage rite of passage amongst the Mexican political elite, you know, the famous dedazo or finger point of the Party of the Institutional Revolution, the pre-party that governed the country for 71 years, in a country where the figure of the president had been the central point of the concentration of power for its entire 20th century history. Felipe Calderon comes in only the second so-called democratic election in the 20th century, marred by allegations of electoral fraud and with the weakest mandate ever. What does he do? In his first week in office, he raises the salary of the Mexican army generals. He appears in public in military uniform, and he orders the army into the streets to wage a so-called, his own term, war on drug traffickers.
Well, that sounds like a good idea on the face of it.
Well, it sounds like a good idea if you haven't studied a lot of Mexican history and don't know that the federal army and the federal police have been organizing drug trafficking for the past 70 years.
Yeah, they're part of the apparatus.
It's so, and what's become impossible, if you said that 4 years ago even, people would say, okay, you're a conspiracy theorist, what's your proof? And if you went through the long list of federal police officers and army generals who have at one point or another fallen because they became, you know, they got busted, and through getting busted showed the vast network of control that they had, then you've got the bad apple theory, right? Well, that guy, he got busted, doesn't that mean that law and order works? But if you have a pattern, systemic pattern of over, you know, decades of top level administrators of this industry being involved in either the federal police or the army, it seems like that should reveal something a little bit more consistent, systemic, than a bad apple.
When we talk about, now, yeah, go ahead.
But No, sorry, but now it's actually become impossible to deny the level of infiltration and participation of the federal forces in this industry. The police force is where Calderon has kind of tried to concentrate all of the attention of the idea of corruption. And while trying to maintain the armed forces as the still pristine, still untouched institution. But that view is entirely naive. But again, the facts. So Calderon sends the army into the streets in December 2006. The year before, maybe, I think the number is somewhere around 700 people had been executed in these kind of gangland-style killings across the country. In 2007, it was more than 2,700. In 2008, the number went up to almost 5,000. In 2009, the number went up to 10,000. In 2010, the number was at 15,000. So what happened? You send the army into the streets, and it's a splurge of executions. Now, of those 38,000 people that have been killed, do you know how many are army soldiers?
Oh, how many?
70.
Uh-huh.
That's not a war. That's not the army engaging in open combat with an enemy and sustaining casualties. And take the case of just Ciudad Juarez. In Ciudad Juarez, the federal government sent the army into the streets in, it was late 2008, early 2009. In that year, when the army hit the streets in Ciudad Juarez, the execution rate doubled overnight. When they took the army out and sent the federal police in, it shot up by 50% again.
Hmm. Well, we're talking about, well, let me reintroduce you. John Gibler is my guest. He has a brand new book out from City Lights Publishers, To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. And we're talking about the situation there. Well, in state society, it is the armed might of the political state that enforces the laws. I mean, certainly the history of the political state is mostly over the last 6,000-8,000 years has been political corruption and having it operate solely for the people at the top. But we like to think that at some point we've gotten, you know, we've advanced to a situation where that apparatus, particularly the armed apparatus, is doing the best for the people. When it is thoroughly corrupt and it's armed, we're kind of screwed, aren't we?
It becomes a very dangerous circumstance. I think in this case in Mexico, there's a very young movement to oppose the drug war that has largely been started by family members of people who've been killed in regions across the country. There have been very large marches against the army and against the drug war in Ciudad Juarez, in Sinaloa, and most recently, and definitely the largest of the marches, in Cuernavaca and Mexico City, inspired by the resistance stance that the poet Javier Cecilia has taken after his son was found murdered, one of seven young people who had been executed and stuffed in the trunk of a car in Morelos. So that becomes, you know, you can't probably take to the streets in some kind of a selective armed engagement with the state in a context like this. The disparity is too great. And so people take to the streets in gestures of civic resistance. The strongest point of the state is, of course, its monopoly on violence, or so-called monopoly on violence, its use of violence. Its weakest point is its hunger and need for the perception of legitimacy, because it sustains its violence through the idea that it is, as you said, just. It's a violence exercised for the people, for protection, for security. And that sense of legitimacy is, in fact, its weakest point. If you can attack that, strip that, then it exposes the state, the violence, for what it is, intensely unjust, and the state will have to readjust in some way.
Yeah, I mean, it can't function forever as simply being a racket, although any number of certainly political states have. John Gibler, when we hear about these mass executions, these horrible torture deaths, these finding sometimes hundreds of bodies, these were carried out by someone. And there's this one particularly violent group, you probably know more so about others, the Zetas, and they're staffed by human beings, somebody that could have been a farmer or a pharmacist or anything other under the sun, or maybe came up here to the United States legally or illegally to get some income, but wound up to be a vicious murderer. But there's got to be a social component to this. This is not what people do in a society that works. So who are these, I assume, mostly young men who have such a murderous bent?
I think that the majority of the lower ranks of the death squads come from the marginalized classes, both rural and urban poor. And I think in many cases, it's definitely complex how someone can get to a position where they feel comfortable doing those things. But I think one of the most destructive social aspects leading to it is the climate of impunity and the fact that kids see violence take place and nothing happened afterwards, and it become normalized. And that was a culture of impunity in Mexico is deeply entrenched in something that is, long precedes this drug war. The drug war steps into or takes place inside that climate of impunity.
And meaning, let me just be clear. What that means is that people can commit horrendous acts, illegal acts, horrific acts, and nothing happens. They can, in other words, commit them with impunity.
Exactly. Yeah. That people get, killed, and then they're never held to account. They aren't arrested. They aren't put on trial. They aren't standing before a jury of their peers, all of this. And impunity has been built into the legal system from the get-go. But, Cicely, you have just very briefly high-profile cases. Not a single high-level political assassination in Mexico has ever been solved. And that ranges from the presidential candidate Luis Colosio to human rights activists like Digno Ochoa, or even massacres like that at Aguas Blancas in Guerrero State in 1995, where finally the evidence was simply irrefutable that the governor of the state had ordered the massacre and that the secretary of government of the state, the number two position, had carried it out with the involvement of over 200 state police. The fact that there was a leaked video the police had filmed of themselves doing it, it was part of these irrefutable facts. But even there, in that case, the Supreme Court said, yes, there was involvement at the highest levels of government, but we lack the constitutional authority to judge someone, a governor. Hmm. And so they pitched it off to the Senate. The Senate then did the exact same thing. They said, we acknowledge that there was involvement at the highest levels of government, and we lack the authority to constitutional authority to judge a governor. So, boom, pitch it to the Supreme Court, and it remained in that limbo. The governor, Ruben Figueroa, quietly resigned and is still a multimillionaire businessman in Guerrero. And so that you grow up in that kind of a context of impunity where people can kill and just go about their business. Again, people can kill and go about their business if they're from the political class. These last several years, there's been kind of crucible effect with the economic crisis and this just bloodshed unleashed on the country in a context of total impunity. When I say that, the Mexican federal government's own statistic says that they've opened up investigations into less than 5% of the homicides that have taken place over the last 4 years. So that means of 38,000 people killed, some 35-plus thousand murders are guaranteed impunity. No one's even investigating them.
Well, John Gibbler, one of the things that I've noticed both in our conversation here and in your article in counterpunch.org is that you say the names of many of the victims. And is this purposeful? I mean, are you, it's like you want to say, hey, look, these aren't nameless, faceless, anonymous death. In fact, the name of your article is A War of Anonymous Death. Is this intentional? I mean, do you feel that, you know, that thing where often where people have been killed by death squads and people will say their names, like at the School of the Americas, and they say presente, you know, I mean, that they're still here, that they haven't just died an anonymous death. I mean, is this intentional on your part?
Absolutely intentional. It's a combat strategy against the numbing effects of all of this death. Like, I think one of the things that is an assumed logic in this government drug war is that if you're dead, you're dirty. If you end up dead on a street corner, your body wrapped up in a blanket with a note stabbed into your torso referencing some drug cartel, everybody's going to assume you must have been in the game. You had it coming in some way. So they assume your guilt without knowing anything about you. And they strip you of your humanity. The killers kill you, of course, strip you of your life. But when they dress you up like that with these, you know, aesthetic kind of narco messaging death theatrics, they strip you of your humanity, of your name. You appear on the front page of a newspaper as just this nameless mass of death, not as a human being. And so researching the stories of people who have been killed, finding out who they were, and in many cases finding out that they had absolutely nothing to do with the drug trade, period. The case of a 16-year-old boy, Cristobal Trinidad, who took his mother's car to a car mechanic shop with his brother to get the handbrake fixed, the emergency brake. And they were there when a death squad stormed in and killed 9 people, including the 16-year-old.
You know, I'm going to – let me interrupt you because this is so important, and you chronicle it so well in To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. But for our radio audience, we have about 4 minutes left, and I want to – you know, people could be just listening and going, tisk, tisk, you know, how terrible it is, like people in the suburbs look into Detroit and say tisk, tisk as well without seeing any connection. Let's talk a little about responsibility. Is someone in Grosse Pointe who's smoking marijuana from Mexico or doing cocaine that is – traveled through that country, do they bear any direct responsibility? I mean, should or is it in the drug laws themselves, or both?
I think everybody's involved. By everybody, I mean people passing the, you know, hardcore prohibitionist drug laws. I think people snorting cocaine in the bathroom of a nightclub, people smoking out and listening to Pink Floyd. Everybody's involved in this mess. And that joint involvement, at least, you know, we could think of it as a joint union. Like, we're all involved in this, so we need to get our stuff together and figure out how to solve it and how to address it. I think just like in the 1990s, there was the big movement for social responsibility and anti-sweatshop campaigns that said, you know, don't shop at the Gap and don't buy Coca-Cola because they're killing union workers in Colombia. Something similar is immediately, I think, relevant in the case of most of these illegal narcotics. If you're shooting heroin, snorting coke, or smoking crack, then you're supporting an industry that in the past 4 years has led to the deaths of more than 38,000 people in one country alone. That's not talking even about the drug war deaths in the United States, in Detroit, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Colombia, just in Mexico alone. So, yes, I think absolutely involved, and people should consider the ethical implications of consuming a lot of these products under the way they're currently managed in society, with this absolute prohibition and then an illegal commodity trade that also traffics in weapons and killing.
Again, let me see. Ooh, we got 2 minutes left now, and you covered that, I think, pretty well. What about the drug laws? I'm pretty libertarian about it. I would say, you know, if anything, if there's any problems with drug use or the drug abuse, that's a community health problem, not something for law enforcement. What do you think? Should we just repeal all the drug laws? I'm okay with that.
I think we can all agree, I think we should all agree that our current laws are completely unsustainable and they're colossal failures. Everybody should be able to point at what we've got now and say, this is not working. It's a horrible failure. We need something different. I personally think that some combination of strategies of both legalization, regulation, and then most importantly, as you said, shifting energy, resources, money, time and energy to public health responses, harm reduction, clinics, and education campaigns, especially in schools, that try to, A, keep kids off from getting on in the first place, and not with some just moralistic say-no-to-drugs garbage that doesn't pay any attention to the social realities of these kids' lives.
And kids don't pay any attention to, right.
It becomes exciting to thwart that kind of authority. I grew up in that era, the Reagan era, right? And, you know, just say no to drugs, and you're like, yeah, right. But, I mean, like a real public education campaign rooted in the social realities of communities and saying, you know, let's consider what, like, these substances have done to our communities. And I think there are many cases where people would say, you know, crack cocaine, that stuff's just really bad. That stuff's really destructive. Pot, I don't know. You know, a lot of people seem to do it and live long lives and not hurt anybody. Maybe that stuff isn't as bad.
Well, let's leave it at that because there's so much more room to explore this in John Gibler's new book, To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. It's published by City Lights, a wonderful and important publisher. You can go to citylights.com and you'll find John's book there. You also can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and there'll be a link to the book as well. John Gibler, thanks again for being on the program.
Thanks so much, Peter. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Are you an inventor? Or do you know an inventor who would like to attempt to have an idea or invention patented and submitted to industry? For free information on how to get started, call InventHelp toll-free at 1-800-762-7000. InventHelp is America's largest invention company. Their referrals have helped inventors secure more than 7,000 patents, and they can provide free inventors information for you. Find out how to record your invention's date of origination and get an informative brochure and other material of interest to new inventors. Get started by calling 1-800-762-7000. Even if you have an idea for improving an existing product, you'll want to get this free inventor's information from InventHelp. Find out how to try to patent your invention and submit it to industry. Call now to get your free inventor's information. Call 1-800-762-7000. That's 1-800-762-7000.
Mortgages should be illegal because you're getting robbed every month. With a typical $200,000 30-year mortgage, you'll end up paying over $400,000 after interest. Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My proven system can eliminate your mortgage and all your debts. Let me send you a powerful free CD. For your free CD, call 1-800-933-2911. 1-800-933-2911. 1-800-933-2911.
My mom is my hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved. She helps them get out, even when she can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My mom is a firefighter, but the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
My dad is my hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. He helps them get out, even when he can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My dad is a firefighter, but the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
When it's raining hard outside, can your roof still keep out the leaks inside? If it's time for a new roof, get your roofing installed the right way with Sears. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. You can